Coming up on Twit, I'm Devendra Hardwar, senior editor and Engadget. We've got Anthony Ha, Doc Rock, and Nicholas Del Leon. We'll be talking about some new AI news, including Bloomberg's AI large language model, which is finely tuned to financial news. And of course, we'll be talking about the latest news from Elon Musk's Twitter. It turns out open sourcing a bunch of code didn't work out as well as he thought it did.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 922, recorded Sunday, April 9th, 2023. AI Hustlers.
This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by Cisco Meraki, with employees working in different locations. Providing a unified work experience seems as easy as herding cats. How do you rein in so many moving parts? The Meraki Cloud Managed Network. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. And by ZipRecruiter. Whether you're starting a new business or growing one, if you want to be successful, you need the most talented people on your team. That's where ZipRecruiter comes in. Right now, you can try it free at ziprecruiter.com/twit. And by Miro. Miro is your team's visual platform to connect, collaborate, and create together. Tap into a way to map processes, systems, and plans with the whole team and get your first three boards for free to start creating your best work yet at Miro.com/podcast.
It's time for another Twit This Week in Tech. I'm Devendra Hardwar. Leo Laporte is on vacation for a while now. I saw he was in Portugal, and I think he and Lisa are just like perusing around Europe at this point. But we've got a great panel this week. We've got Anthony Ha, VP of Content at ENIAC Ventures. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hey, I'm really excited to be here. It's great to see you again,
Devendra. Super excited to chat. Yeah, I mean, I used to work with Anthony, so we are just going to reminisce during this episode. But great to have you on Twit for the first time. Amazing, Anthony.
I know. It's so exciting.
We've got Doc Rock, YouTube superstar. Doc Rock, what is up, Doc?
How you doing? It is so good to be here and get to hang out with you guys today.
You're going
to
get what's up, Doc, for I feel like for the rest of your life. Because
yeah, it's a thing. It's a thing. I'm used to it.
And we've got Nicholas De Leon, senior reporter at Consumer Reports. Hey, Nicholas, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
Doing okay. How are things at Consumer Reports? Because I feel like That is a publication people don't talk about enough, but I feel like it's still super valuable for many, many readers, right?
Yeah, no, we're still kicking. I think we're nearly 100 years old at this point. But yeah, still kicking around. I primarily cover laptops and wireless routers and right to repair stuff and other fun stuff like that. But yeah, still around, still rating refrigerators and lawnmowers and cars, and I guess EVs are now a thing now.
Listen, even I'm like reviewing EVs now. So yeah,
I'm reviewing e-bikes right now. So I'm watching you.
Nice. I mean, we can talk about that if anybody's thinking about EVs or alternative means of transportation at some point. But yeah, so thank you, Nicholas. And yeah, looking forward to this chat, guys. This is a great group of folks. And I feel like to kick things off, it's one of two things. It feels like every week, I do the Engadget podcast as well. And every week we are looking at the news, and it's either AI or it's whatever the hell Elon Musk is doing now, like how he is messing up. So do you guys have a preference? Any votes here, AI or Elon Musk? Do we start with the good or the bad, or I guess the in-between?
I'm all about AI these days. So.
All about the AI. Okay, Doc Rock.
Your socks.
there's a bunch of things happening. It's not as big as the past few weeks where I feel like, you know, we saw GPT-4 get announced. We saw Google release Bard to the public, and this week there's like less major news, but a few like important things. I think something a lot of people were talking about was the news that President Biden basically says that you know, he's eyeing the dangers around AI and is aware that this is a thing that we need to be paying attention to. And unfortunately, that Reuters article is link blocked for me now. But I saw the story going around because it's interesting that Biden, I think, has like through osmosis and through, you know, whatever people are telling him, has like gathered enough around what's going on with AI. What do you guys feel about this response? Because I feel like this is this is kind of how the government is viewing things now. It seems like they're aware of the danger, but also trying to tell companies to be a little more careful about how quickly they move forward. Any thoughts on this?
I think we're going to see a slowdown starting because this first, it's not really the first 6 months. Let's just be straight honest. We all know because we're in tech, this stuff has been popping for a while. All myriad sorts of apps that we use, even something as simple as, you know, taking a picture in any of the various phones and the phones bless the picture before you decide to send it out. Like that's already doing some. So we've known for a while. But to the Muggleverse, this is all relatively new to them. And the scary thing to them is the generative AI. It's mostly scary because the news is having fun making it scary.
I think it is still, it could still be plenty scary too, but
it has some fear stuff in it. For the most part, us general tech community people, we're not looking to do anything ill. We're trying to have fun and get to whatever our favorite sci-fi movie was back in the day, Team Star Wars. I think that now it is good that they're paying attention. I just hope that they don't do something weird, dumb, knee-jerk reaction and, like, we're just going to ban it like Italy rather than trying to figure it out. Let's just come on and, you know, try to aloha more it, gone, out of here. You know, like, I don't want to see that, right? I want to see it continue to move and do the amazing things that it can do. Unfortunately, our culture is greedy enough that there will always be people that try to buck the system.
I mean, I totally see that. Anthony, Nicholas, like, what are your thoughts on Biden's response to AI? And I mean, where do you guys stand right now? Because things have gotten, it is wild. It is wild how quickly things have progressed. Like, you know, Doc Rock, I hear you. We know certain things. We've seen computer vision. We've seen like Google Photos. We've seen our iPhones like touching up our photos. But now it's like they are straight up just pulling the vast like resources of human knowledge to talk to us in very human sounding ways and pull facts. And to me, that is the point where it's getting a little scary. But yeah, Anthony, Nicholas, any thoughts on what Biden is saying?
I mean, I'm not necessarily convinced that like, and there'll be like any immediate action just because he's talked about it, right? I mean, my reaction really was, oh, like, wow.
Oh, yeah, that's a thing.
He even
that's
knows this is this stuff is happening. Somebody is telling him what's going on. You know, certainly there are probably some people who have his ear who are like, oh, we should be concerned about this. I think that generally the lag between we make a statement of we are concerned to actual regulation takes a while. I mean, certainly we've seen that with, you know, crypto, that there were a lot of statements, not a lot of actual action. Maybe that's starting to change. So I think it was interesting. I'm not convinced that there's going to be sort of any immediate steps taken by the government.
Government is not famously fast in America, especially when it comes to regulation or new tech. Nicholas, your thoughts?
Yeah. No, I can't imagine Biden is devoting too much of his day to thinking about AI. To be honest, it feels like he has bigger things on his plate than like ChatGPT or any of the AI kind of hustlers out there. So I don't really have any, not confidence, but I it just feels like it's something that someone slipped under his desk.
Like, I'm sure somebody sent him the like super cool Brandon photos, right? Or like the sort of like the Biden memes that are going around. And I'm sure he's seen the Pope meme, and I'm sure he's just like, oh, this is the thing. And people have probably talked about the risks. But, you know, Doc, one of my favorite sci-fi, you know, stories, franchises is Battlestar Galactica. And famously, there's no AI in Battlestar Galactica because they destroyed us. It was very bad. And that was kind of like a core point of that. I mean, that goes back to like Foundation and so many other stories too. I don't want to be too fearful here, but it does feel like, I feel like everyone is feeling the sort of whiplash that's happening. It's like, oh, this thing is cool. And oh, this thing is moving really fast. And oh, I can't keep up with what's happening. Oh, this thing is reshaping a huge portion of culture so quickly. It's, you know, mimicking the Pope in a Balenciaga puffy jacket. It is doing things at a time when misinformation is so rampant and so dangerous. To me, it's like all these things coming together that makes it kind of scary. Like, Doc, do you think we're moving too quickly? Because you said you were worried about a slowdown.
I don't. The thing that I'm having a problem with, which is just me, is we don't want to take responsibility for vetting our own facts. Mm-hmm. So misinformation kind of sort of shouldn't exist because you can personally double check everything, double, triple check. And yes, there are cases where you can triple check and then, you know, still miss, but people aren't even checking. They're just taking things at face value and then trying to blame someone else for giving them the wrong information. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's that's not a thing.
I mean, we've already proven we're bad at finding, you know, discerning facts and information. But the AI thing is just like, it is so easy. It makes it so easy. Like, you could be surfing Twitter and just be like, oh, you get a flash of a Balenciaga Pope. And you're like, your brain doesn't have time to figure out if that's real or not. But flash forward to you at the bar with friends or something. You're like, oh, yeah, is the Pope wearing puffy jackets now? Like, what?
Here's the thing. The Balenciaga Pope one to me was funny because... Yeah. Okay, so let's just take any octogenarian uncle. Who do you know at his age is rocking a Balenciaga? I mean, that was just, I mean,
it's the Pope.
No standard dude. Even the Pope, like he doesn't know. Just like Nicholas said about Biden knows it's AI. Wow, man, the Pope don't know what Balenciaga is. You know, he's been sheltered his whole life. He's
up there. He's in Italy. He's in a pretty... he's at the source.
I just thought it was funny that the Balenciaga was seen as like an upgrade over the Pope's normal like robes. Like normal there's one robes. Pope. That Balenciaga jacket anyone could buy with enough money. So it's like...
There you go.
He's already got the most exclusive clothing items on the planet. So...
Totally. I feel like that's part of the thing where like... Part of me is like, no, that can't be real, but also could easily be real. Pope has access to like vast amounts of wealth, and the point is he doesn't show it, but we know the Vatican's like all dolled up with all sorts of stuff. So kind of in the AI news, we did see the story about Bloomberg announcing its own large language model. And this one's interesting because I feel like a lot of people don't realize, you know, Bloomberg at its core is a technology company. That's something Michael Bloomberg spent a lot of time talking about when he was mayor of New York and when I was covering startups there and when I was on the team with Anthony back then. Bloomberg would always talk about like, yeah, he's the original data guy. For people who don't know, Bloomberg is more than just a news site or, you know, a newspaper. They are known for the Bloomberg terminals, which, you know, track and offer vast amounts of financial data to investment bankers and all sorts of people. Those terminals cost tons of money to access, and that is Bloomberg's big money. So they announced a large language model, a 50 billion parameter language model that is totally tuned to financial tasks. And I almost feel like, man, it took them, I guess it didn't take them that long, but I felt like this was inevitable because of all companies to do this, it would be the company that's already like made its entire existence on data. Any thoughts on this and how this could change things for bankers or the financial, you know, sector?
I will say that one concern I have is that what has been surprising to me in terms of this current wave of like ChatGPT type examples and use cases is realizing how bad AI is at fact checking. That like there are the things that I thought would be really... In my head, like AI would always sound robotic, but it would be like very factual. And that turns out to be the opposite of, at least if we take, you know, ChatGPT as sort of the paradigm of current AI, like is actually, it sounds very natural, but it's just full of BS and full of wrong facts. Now you imagine like you're somebody trying to, you know, trade stocks based on financial information and you're using this interface that half the time just gives you incorrect information. I feel like that could go pretty badly. I mean, I'm like, sure they've thought this through, but it's one of those things that sounds like a good fit, but like, actually, I don't know that I've never been a, you know, day trader or anything, but I would be a little bit concerned about using this too extensively right away.
I feel
here's the difference, though. So here's the difference in their data set. Okay, so ChatGPT, I'm trying to help so many of my friends get their head around this. ChatGPT right now is Doogie Howser, right? You guys might be way too young for that. Anyway, so he was the doctor from like middle school, like 14-year-old doctor, graduated.
Yeah. Even as a kid, I was like, I don't think this premise holds up, but okay.
Well, let me let you know, the real deal, Doogie Howser, Michael Nguyen, is across the street at Jabson Medical School here at University of Hawaii, and he's already a doctor, and he's, what, 17 years old? So we actually have the real deal, Doogie Howser, across the street from me. Anyway, so this thing is like that. He has all the intelligence in the world, but not enough experience that he still needs coaching from the experienced people. So the premise of that show was always he can do all these incredible things, but he's still a kid. So mom and dad, you know, friends and coworkers had to rally around him, help him out. This is where the AI model is right now. What Bloomberg is doing is working off a data set that's very specific data set. What ChatGPT
is done. This is proprietary stuff that only Bloomberg has.
What ChatGPT has done is combed the internet. So the reason why ChatGPT is so bad at fact-checking is twofold. One, it combed the internet. So it grabbed all kind of crazy nonsense. But at the same token, people don't even know how to decide what's fact and fiction yet. People can be easily snowed. So there is a lot of information written by people in their brain as factual. And they really, really mean it. We all have that one uncle or neighbor that really believes in the shadow people and Slender Man and whatever. And
I mean,
love them.
At best, that I hope that's what they believe in, the Slender Man, and not other things.
Oh, man, my neighbor really believes Slender Man is real. I'm not even joking, right? It's kind of a thing. We crack up laughing. And he's always talking about the parallel universe, all this other crazy stuff. But he's such a genuinely nice guy that we don't really make fun of him. But if he had a blog and he had been writing all of this stuff down for the last 10 years, that's part of the data set. And the model is too young to know how to filter the difference. But the model will grow up just like a teenager.
I mean, so GPT-4 is supposedly better than ChatGPT, which is GPT 3.5, right? So, and what they're saying here is the Bloomberg thing. I forget which version of GPT it's specifically based
on. I think it's 4.
It is based on 4. But it is getting better. Like the things you're talking about, Anthony, like that does worry me too. Like at Engadget, we've tested out ChatGPT doing things like, hey, make me a table of specs comparing, you know, the iPhone 13 to the Pixel 7 or 6 or something. And sometimes those specs would be wrong for no reason. Like it would give me wrong dimensions or wrong weight. And I'm like, where are you pulling this from? So that does kind of
somebody
make it,
wrote
like,
it wrong on the net. That's the part.
That's
the part that's crazy. Somebody actually wrote it wrong on the net. Mm-hmm. Okay, like for instance, right when it's time to get a phone, right? That week that we're waiting, we already pre-ordered it. Let's be honest, right? But that week that we waited, what are we doing? We're watching, you know, you guys and the other contemporaries. You know, being the X2A man, I was there back in the beginning. That's what people used to come into our content. We always blew up during phone week. What's incredible to me is, even then, sometimes whoever has the phone and doing the report, they get stuff wrong from a conceptual level because there's amount of human in it. And it's not that it's a spec or something. It's the way they might look at a particular feature and maybe not fully understand it, because what people don't realize about the tech people, we get a box of stuff every week. We got so many things that we're doing, and you kind of mix things together. Sometimes you got it in your hand for 2 days before Apple says give it back. Mm-hmm. So you didn't get a chance to dig all the way deep, and you get the flame wars in the comments. I can't believe you missed this. Well, you come over here and try to write 7 articles in 3 hours.
You can't do it all, man.
With the editor barking down your neck, right? You know what I'm saying? So that's why even some of the information it got itself is wrong, because all of us have written something wrong in a tech article at one point in time.
Yeah, that is also, I guess, another reason not to be too afraid of any of these like generative chatbots, because they're still dependent on information from us, and they can't fully replace us yet. But who knows? Who knows like where things will go? It feels like it is moving just so quickly. And to me, that is my main concern. Because, like, guys, we have lived through the era of crypto dudes. You know, we've lived through the Web3 era. Meta is still called Meta because, you know, Mark Zuckerberg really wanted to bank on the metaverse. And, like, it felt like we've had these waves of, like, oh, this is the next big thing. And, hasn't really worked out well for a lot of those crowds. My fear is, like, I'm looking at AI and being like, oh yeah, this is actually the thing. This is the thing that is going to make a big impact for the way we live our lives. And we are utterly prepared for it as a society, as a, you know, the government isn't, these companies aren't. But the only thing kind of forcing this is OpenAI and like the competitive spirit, right? Everybody wants to be in on this. Otherwise, they're going to be left behind. So that's why the Microsoft thing happened so quickly, and that's why Google's being forced to push Bard out. There's some good analysis from Neiman Lab about the Bloomberg thing, kind of putting a little bit of cold water on it. You know, the point is, like, we're going to see a lot of these, like, very domain-specific uses of large language models. A couple of weeks ago, Adobe and NVIDIA had a whole bunch of news announcing like how they were going to make it easier for other companies to kind of build their own things based on their specific knowledge. So we're going to see more of these things. We don't know how good they're going to be, and their usefulness is going to depend on like the source data. The Bloomberg one is interesting because it's Bloomberg. It's freaking, they have like the financial data. They have so much information. I've never used a Bloomberg terminal. The extent that I have seen one in action, I think, is on the show Industry on HBO, which is a very good show. Are you guys watching Industry?
Oh, no, yeah, I'm still in my succession mode.
Wait, Anthony, you're not watching Industry? Because I feel like it is very much like among the things you guys would talk about on
Like Succession scratches that itch for me. But I think once Succession is over, I'll catch up on Industry.
Yeah, so yeah, I will shut this out. Everybody knows Succession is a great show. Everyone's told you to watch Succession. But Industry on HBO is very much like that vein. It's almost like they're in the same universe, to be honest. But it's set in London at an investment bank. And it follows a young group of bankers like being terrible people, basically, but also I think there's a lot of statements on like the sense of the state of banking right now and the world we're in. Doc Rock, you had mentioned that Italy announced that they want to ban ChatGPT. We can definitely talk further about that. I believe they have done it.
Yes,
fully, right?
Went all the way in.
Mm-hmm. And they did that because of privacy violations. And I feel, okay, maybe a little too much, but also it is interesting that there's a government that's out there enough to be like, hey, this is bad for privacy on many, many levels. Like, maybe we should do something. But I think for a lot of, as we've seen with like, the European privacy rules, like sometimes they tend to go too far, but I'm kind of impressed they did something at all. Do you guys have any thoughts about this? Because I don't think it's ever going to be banned fully in America. I feel like AI is something American companies are just like fully all in on. The government wants it to be a thing. We want to defeat China, which is what everybody, you know, is the main call to action right now. So I feel like this will never happen in the US. But any thoughts on Italy doing this?
I mean, I guess if I think about it more just like domestically, I feel like what we're more likely to see more of is like, you know, I mean, this is a little bit old now, but the, mm-hmm. you know, New York schools banned ChatGPT, right? And
yeah.
And I think like, it may be more like banned in certain contexts than you are likely to see it completely banned.
Also, how do you ban ChatGPT in the school, right? They're going to go home. They're going to go to the library Wi-Fi or something and, you know, do whatever.
Right.
You
want to do. And I mean, I think in general, my feeling is that, you know, that people are going to get access to this in some way. These technologies are going to be developed. And so you can maybe do something like this in the short term because you're just like, oh my God, like this is so scary. We need to figure it out. And mm-hmm. so let's ban it while we like put other rules in place, maybe makes more sense. But
it's like pulling the emergency brakes while you try to figure it out, I guess. Yeah.
Right. But the idea that like, you know, that you're just like, well, we're just going to shut this out. And like the rest of the world will sort of just go on without us seems not like a long-term solution.
Maybe not a great solution, I guess, if you want to stay competitive, which is the sort of like weird push and pull. Nicholas, do you have any thoughts on this? Because
if I were just an Italian person, I would kind of be bummed out that my government has just like banned, you can't use it anymore. It's like, okay, well, that's, I mean, if I just moved across the border to Germany, can I use it? If I moved to like, New York, can I use it? It doesn't, I guess it feels like a, like you said, like an emergency break. Like, let's just hold on for a second. So maybe that's okay, but just to kind of an indefinite ban, that seems like if I were an Italian entrepreneur, I would be like, well, why am I even here then? Like, if I'm not going to have access to the latest tools and tech, this place is no longer working for me. I'll go somewhere where I can develop my talents elsewhere, you know?
It is funny how we're seeing different people approach this idea too, because it was last week or 2 weeks ago, there was the letter from the Future of Humanity Institute, the thing that Elon Musk backs to say, hey, let's put a 6-month pause on AI on, you know, GPT beyond ChatGPT or beyond GPT-4 because my companies have not caught up yet. That is, a lot of this always seems self-serving. But if a government does it, that just seems out of fear. I don't know like fully like what the plan is. Are they just going to sit back and see what happens before they allow it again?
Here's what's funny about this to me. My niece goes to Guy Kawasaki's alma mater. Mm-hmm. And I would look at the date real quick. February 17th, they sent a letter to all the parents, and I'm on the list as her uncle. I don't know how I got on the list, but my sister-in-law put me there. and so I get this email, and it's from the chancellor, And he's like, I know you guys read all this stuff and you're hearing about the fears of going, what's going on. You're hearing about schools in New York and other, you know, districts locking it down. Here's going to be our approach at Iolani School. We are putting together a task force of teachers and senior students that will look at how we can effectively use this for the betterment of our students. We're not going to ban it, mm-hmm. but we are going to take a responsible and sensible approach. And we have an ever active team working. Any parents that want to come and join, if you want to volunteer to be on this panel, or whatever, please come in. And we're going to meet every week, you know, on Zoom and to see how it's going. So it's funny, right? The private school takes that approach. And when they get out in the world, people get mad because, oh, how come the private school kids always have a leg up on, you know, the regular school kids? Because the current administrations in a lot of states, they don't want to spend the time, or maybe they don't get paid enough to.
They don't, you know, literally
they actually don't get paid enough.
This, they don't get paid enough. Right. There's yeah. no. I mean, so, this is it's an impossible task we're talking about. Right.
100%.
It's like, hey, this thing that didn't exist 6 months ago, you need to be an expert in it now. And you need also, we need to have a, we need to have a console. We need to figure out like how we integrate this into our like teaching, you know, regimen. It seems so rough. I can understand why Italy was just like, no thanks. Yep. Or why
no time, no that. Time, yeah. no money. Nobody really understands it.
Mm-hmm.
No, but the thing that I wonder, and I have to call a couple of my classmates from college that live there. I'm like, yo, can you just pop through a VPN and still get in? Because if you blocked it and the VPN still worked, then that's just...
I mean, usually yes.
Usually yes, right.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing. It is a weird thing. It's sort of like, I remember when the internet was becoming a thing in the mid-90s, and I was lucky enough to have a computer at home to spend time tinkering and playing around with HTML and doing stuff. So when I went to school... the librarians would always be like, what are you doing? Like, why are you going to websites so quickly? Why are you hitting refresh so often? Which is a question I have gotten because, like, it's not loading fast enough. Having that opportunity at home gave me a leg up, and I do feel like having a chance to play with ChatGPT in the actual school environment is going to be kind of essential for kids moving forward. But we have no clue. We have no idea kind of how this stuff is going to affect anything. Because the New York schools are worried about plagiarism, right? They're worried about kids using it just to like have a paper written immediately or solve their homework problems super quickly, right? Like that seems fair to just pause it for now, I guess.
I'm not a teacher.
Yep.
But this is my thoughts on it, and I'm probably going to catch a lot of flack for this. You know, in school, we all had our favorite teachers, whether it was in high school or, you know, in college or whatever. Your favorite teachers, you normally did really good on the tests because they taught you. If I'm teaching you properly, you have no need to cheat on the test whatsoever. If you're prepared to play a sport or something at the height of its existence, you don't have to cheat, Tom Brady.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're slacking, then you decide to start taking shortcuts. And again, I got it. This is partially on us because we're not paying them enough, which is a whole different conversation, but students don't even try to cheat on the teachers that they like.
Well, it's not even about teaching on cheating on like tests, right? This is like you get homework, right? You get a weekend assignment of like write 500 words, 1,000 words on this book or something. Then it's like, okay, a lot of kids will want to engage on it, but maybe people will use ChatGPT like, hey, help me break down the themes of this book. And then they go and, you know, write something on their own based on that. Like we don't know what's acceptable. We don't know like what counts as plagiarism or not, I guess. I think it's going to be really confusing. Do you guys have thoughts, Nicholas and Anthony?
Yeah, go ahead, Nicholas.
Oh, yeah, no, I was just, it does feel that like ChatGPT in particular is just going to be something that people will put on a resume. Like you just, Microsoft Office skill. It just feels like a thing that you're going to kind of have to need to know how to use to just be competitive with the person next to you. Or just to get your foot in the door. So I do feel that I mean, I get that teachers don't have the resources to teach it. But if I were, like you said, if I were a student, I would want to be messing with this. I would mm-hmm. want, if I were a parent, I would want my kid messing with this all the time, just so that they have the experience of using what is this potentially very important tool, rather than just saying it's banned, you can't use it. My adopted mother is a teacher, a mm-hmm. college professor. I don't know what their ChatGPT plans are, but If you're already talking about like banning it, I feel like the game is already over because it's already in the ether now. It's like you're going to have to like wrestle with the fact that this tool exists, and maybe you should grade tests differently, or maybe you should not have tests, or maybe you should like evaluate knowledge in a different way than something that can be substituted for a quick little prompt, you know?
Mm-hmm. There you go, right there. That's the joint, Nicholas. Evaluate knowledge in a different way, because we've all been proven that testing is just borderline useless.
I mean, I don't disagree. And also homework. I feel like my daughter is 4, my son is just turned 1, and it's like, I don't want them to be going to schools where I went to, where I would be carrying, I had a 50-pound book bag filled with books. I would have hours of homework every night. And I'm like, this is not, I was so great. I was so happy to be done with like middle school and high school, because that didn't seem useful or functional at all, really. I'm very much against like busy work homework. But I feel for teachers. I feel for teachers who aren't supported. Abbott Elementary is a really good show that really confronts like what public school teachers have to do with like very limited systems right now. Asking a public high school teacher to completely reshape the way they think of how they grade and judge kids, because this new tech appeared 6 months ago, not even 6 months ago, like 4 months ago. It just seems like, man, it seems so unfair. And I don't know. I kind of don't know where we go from there with all this. Also kind of part of this story about, I guess, the dangers of generative AI. And we saw the story about Midjourney announcing that they're ending their free trial after that, partially that thing, the Balenciaga Pope story, that picture went everywhere. There were also pictures of Donald Trump getting arrested, which were not real, which were, you know, generated by AI. It is funny to me that Midjourney, a company that is, you know, became very famous by saying, hey, we have created this amazing image tool that will create, you know, make realistic images of whatever you type into, you know, and we're going to open it up to everybody for free, I believe. Nobody saw this coming. I don't know. Do you guys feel like this was inevitable after Midjourney opening things up so quickly?
This one's a tough one. And I'll tell you why. There's no way I looked at especially the police image, and for 1 second thought that was a real image.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't even take a discerning eye of a photographer or a discerning eye of a creator, eye of both.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so obviously fake. The reflections are wrong. 6 fingers on people's hands, like eye gazes, like, you know, a wall-eyed fish or something. I don't even know how anybody for 1 second would have said that.
I mean, listen, normal people get fooled by all sorts of things. And
this is true.
To me, like, it is good enough. It is good enough to sway elections. It is good enough to sway the public. And to me, that makes it a little dangerous.
That's what makes it scary. Again, I think we should, granted, the tech has to be moderated, but I think this is a time for us to slow down and like go back to re-educating people. People need to take personal responsibility. And maybe we have to find a way to incentivize that responsibility so that they can do it. Because, it's I know it's a long stretch.
It's hopeless. That is a hopeless task.
That hurts my feelings to know that our world is getting that bad that people can't see how obviously fake this is. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but I guess I push back against that a little bit. I mean, I think we should accept responsibility for sure. And I think that there is a useful conversation to be had of like, even before AI, that people should look with any sort of news article or anything they see with a degree of skepticism, not because like, oh, it's like the evil liberal media or whatever, but just because any you know, piece of content is going to be, at least until now, produced by people and is going to be imperfect in some ways. And so you should have a little bit of that. But I think also the truth is, you know, even people like us who think we're more sophisticated about the news, about technology and everything, I'm sure there are things that show up in our social media feeds that we don't examine that closely. I don't think anyone can sort of live in a way where they just everything. I mean, and I'm somebody who's, you know, worked as a fact checker before, like actually like doing serious fact checking, that is a lot of work. There's like basic BS testing that you can do. But in terms of like, oh, like, here's a quote that sounds kind of plausible from this person, let me like actually find the primary source from where this comes from or this stat or whatever. That actually is really difficult a lot of times, because especially on the internet, because things start to get repeated. And so figuring out where something actually came from is really hard. And so I think that I And again, maybe I don't necessarily disagree with Doc that much on the ultimate solution, which is I do think that as a person, you have to take responsibility, especially if you're going to act on this information, whether that's buying stock, how you're going to vote, things like that. But at the same time, I think there have to be sort of societal solutions as well, because you know, none of us is perfect when it comes to actually assessing these things.
Absolutely. I mean, people have other things going on in their lives. Like, that's the thing. Like, when we focus on fact-checking and looking at media very very thoughtfully, that is work that I feel like normal citizens like don't have time for, right? They're busy taking care of, picking up their kids from school. They're busy getting dinner ready. It is a super tough thing. I'm thinking, I live outside of Atlanta now, guys. I moved from Brooklyn at the start of the pandemic, and I've got a neighbor who is iffy on the concept of seatbelts, and he believes in personal responsibility for keeping himself safe in the car. And I just, this person is an engineer. This person is very like, is a programmer, I assume, like, is smart on some levels, but I have to be like, you know, maybe sometimes this is why regulation exists. This is why, like, I got to protect you from yourself. I'm sorry. You have a child. This is insane. Yeah.
As an ex-paramedic, trust me, I used to be one of those guys. Like, I don't need to wear no things, but I know how to drive. And after about my third or fourth bag, I'm like, okay, seatbelt it is. You know, because what a lot of people don't realize, maybe you get in a wreck, but when you get ejected from a car and then you hit another vehicle that hits another three other vehicles, it's not just you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that, so yeah, this is where the personal responsibility part of it does fail. See, it's, again, this is such a hard conversation because as a tech person, this time is so epic. Like, what's going right now is so epic. We're back at, you know, printing press level days. And yet,
in terms of like how revolutionary a lot of this stuff is,
but the level I think of like just industrial greed has made it that this can't grow the way it should, because there's so much greed, and you know, everybody wants things to be the way that they want it with no understanding of a bigger society. And I guess where it messes me up is I lived in Japan for a little while. The large portion of the population is never going to be everybody, but over 99% of the population will not do anything that was slightly convenient to another person. That's just their culture in general.
Yep.
And that's what makes everybody fall in love with it when you go there.
Even though it is like, I've talked to people who moved there. They're like, oh man, the garbage rules, the rules of like when you put out the trash and like all those sorts of things seem really like stifling in a society. But if it makes everything work, I don't know.
It's stifling to us because we know what the opposite looks like. If you've grown up that way your whole life, you don't even know there anything else exists. And so you're cool with it. And I actually liked it because you get to walk around in clean neighborhoods all the time. There's some hidden gems that are really effed up that will look like, you know, anywhere else in, you know, major city U.S. They're hidden, and they're hidden on purpose because they're trying to, you know, show the rest of the world that it's dope. But yeah, still, it's just in general, I could go, you know, from class and put my laptop on the lunchroom table, go back to class for 2.5 more hours and come back, and my seat has been successfully reserved by my laptop and nobody would touch it.
That's amazing.
You lived in New York. Anthony's in New York. You could turn around to get a tissue and that sucker gone.
You know, it depends. I feel like compassion is shown in different ways in New York, and we can always have this argument, but there is that fun show on Netflix, Old Enough, where it's just like two-year-old kids sent to do like basic shopping tasks for their parents, and it's easy. They can just do it. They can do it because the cars aren't zooming down the streets and people are aware of like children, and society has built itself in a way to take care of kids and the most vulnerable people in that society. And hey, that's a beautiful thing. Doc, to what you're saying, I feel like the whole personal responsibility thing just seems tough because it is individuals, right, who are up against everything going on in their lives, and then these companies, which are funded with tens of billions of dollars from the biggest, you know, technology companies in the world, who want to just win this AI race. They want to beat China, which is a thing a lot of people are thinking about, but they also want to be the dominant one. They feel like this is the new like AI, the new social media race, or the new, you know, the big new tech. And if you don't get out there fast, if you don't like cement yourself there, you're going to miss out entirely on it. I feel like Microsoft is looking at this being like, we're not going to miss the smartphone again. Like, we're not going to miss out on the iPhone, right? We got to be here no matter what happens. And I do feel like we're just like, it's pedal to the floor, like just moving forward on it without really fully taking into account of like what it means for normal people. And I'll tell you guys my personal philosophy when I think about tech and when I write about tech, it's like I fight for the user, right? Like, it all comes back to Tron. It really does. Like, I think about those people and what they have to do and who aren't following all this news and being like, well, no, these images are just coming in your social media feeds and nothing is really stopping it, right? Unless these companies decide the tools they themselves have made have to be stopped. And I guess that's what Midjourney did. But yeah, we are in a strange place. Anthony, Nicholas, any other thoughts on this before we move on?
One thing I was going to add is that as we've all covered tech for a long time on this pod, this definitely feels like the most exciting time. Mm-hmm. I would compare it to the iPhone. Anything after the iPhone till this AI stuff. I mean, I don't know, social, story, Snapchat story. Like, none of this really. This AI stuff is the most excited I've been just as someone interested in technology stuff. And I had a conversation with someone in the AI, and he definitely agreed. Like, this, he wakes up every day excited again for tech, and he's not had that feeling in kind of a long time. But the crypto stuff is interesting, the mobile stuff is interesting, but this AI stuff feels like the most transformative thing. He was like, maybe even since like the days of like Windows 95. He was just slightly older than me. This is whether we need more personal responsibility, whether we need more legislation, fingers crossed, we'll figure it out. But regardless, this just feels like the most exciting and interesting thing. Like, I've never seen Microsoft move this quickly.
Seriously.
In a really long time, you know?
It's just wild. Like, they invited me to the event where they were going to announce it, and I was on vacation. But they gave people basically a week, 5 days, 6 days of heads up time to go to that event.
Wow. Okay.
It's pretty wild. All right. Thanks, guys. We're going to be moving on to that horrible news from Elon Musk in a bit, but let's go on to an ad break from Leo Laporte.
Hey, everybody. Thank you. I know I'm not here. Just pretend I'm not here. But I did want to stop in this previously recorded commercial to tell you about Cisco Meraki. You know the name. Experts in cloud-based networking for hybrid work. Whether your employees are working at home, at a cabin in the mountains, on a lounge chair at the beach, high in the air in a 787, or maybe on a cruise ship like me, a cloud-managed network provides the same exceptional work experience no matter where they are. And you know what? You may as well roll out the welcome mat. Hybrid work is here to stay, so let's do it right. Hybrid work works best in the cloud. It has its perks for both employees and, yes, leaders. Workers can move faster. They can deliver better results with a cloud-managed network. Leaders can automate distributed operations, build more sustainable workplaces, and, maybe most importantly, proactively protect the network. An IDG MarketPulse research report conducted for Meraki highlights the top-tier opportunities in supporting hybrid work. Hybrid work is now a priority for, get this, 78% of C-suite executives. Leaders want to drive collaboration forward while staying on top of boosting productivity and security. But we know hybrid work has its challenges. The IDG report also raised the red flag about security, noting that 48% of leaders report cybersecurity threats as a primary obstacle to improving workforce experiences. But always-on security monitoring is part of what makes the cloud-managed network so awesome. IT can use apps from Meraki's vast ecosystem of partners, turnkey solutions built to work seamlessly with the Meraki cloud platform for asset tracking, location analysis, and more, to gather insights on how people use their workspaces, for instance. In a smart space, environmental sensors can be used to track activity and occupancy levels to stay on top of cleanliness. They also help with hot desking, right? You can reserve workspaces based on vacancy and employee profiles. It also makes it easy for employees to scout out a spot in a snap, reserve it, and have it ready for them when they arrive. And if you have a location in restricted environments, it's going to really help your security with advanced booking, time-based door access, things like that. When it comes to mobile device management, Meraki's got you covered too, with integrating devices and systems that allow IT to manage, update, and troubleshoot company-owned devices, even when the device and the employee are Oh, let's say on a cruise ship, for instance. Turn any space into a place of productivity and empower your organization with the same exceptional experience no matter where they work with Meraki and the Cisco suite of technology. Learn how your organization can make hybrid work work. Visit meraki.cisco.com/twit. I got to go because the shuffleboard tournament's about to begin. But you should go to meraki.cisco.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting This Week in Tech. And don't forget, your support's just as important. You got to go to that site so they know you saw it here, meraki.cisco.com/twit. Now back to the show.
You know what? Let's go on to that terrible Elon Musk news, which I feel like we just got to check in on every week and see what the heck is going on with Twitter. There was a great piece by Ina Fried over at Axios, just pointing out that, you know, Elon Musk's Twitter is not really about free speech. The guy who wanted to buy this company and always talked about, like, man, Twitter is so biased against, towards liberals, and was really proposing more free speech. It's not really living up to that label, I guess. His Twitter is more restrictive than ever. There is the way he's pushing verification, basically getting ready to strip it from people. We're all kind of in the weird space right now, right? Because they announced that legacy blue checks are going to be losing their checks eventually. That was supposed to be April 1st. That didn't happen. There was a report that this is actually a very manual process that Twitter has to do. So like so many things Elon Musk talks about, it is much harder to actually do in practice than just like flipping a switch. We've seen several major accounts like the New York Times say that they are not going to be paying for the much higher $1,000 monthly fee to keep their blue check. So the New York Times said they wouldn't do that. They lost their check mark entirely. And that's a weird retaliatory move. We've also seen celebrities like LeBron James, other organizations, Washington Post, the LA Times have all said that they're not going to pay for this. Seems like this is all kind of backfiring for Twitter and Elon Musk. Like, what are you guys worried about? I assume most of you guys have blue checks. Are you worried about this? Or you just like think this is this a weird place that we've seen Twitter fall to thanks to Elon Musk?
Honestly, it just feels funny at this point.
It's hilarious. You know,
like, yeah. Just watch it go down. Take my blue check mark, please.
Please.
I just feel like at this point, it's just pure Keystone Cops.
Have you guys noticed, right? So New York Times, their check is completely gone, right? Mm-hmm. New York Times books, arts, Chinese, cooking and food, health, photo, New York Times world, science, New York Times travel, all still got checks.
I mean, that's too much work. It's too much work, Doc.
Like, it's silly. It's super silly. It's, yeah, I'm with Anthony 100%.
It's funny. Nicholas, any broad thoughts before we like dive deeper into this?
My broader thoughts are I moved to Tucson, Arizona about 3 months ago. I have more important things to do with my life than worry about whether or not my blue check is there or not. I think it was Thursday or Friday. The Twitter verified account was like manually unfollowing people it had followed. And mm-hmm. It was like certain folks were reacting like it was a five alarm fire or whatever. And I was like, I opened my door and I looked at Mount Lemmon and I was like, I'm going to go hike that tomorrow. That's what's important to me.
That sounds good.
So I'm kind of joking, but I do think that this site has like if Elon were like truly benevolent, he would just shut it down at this point and like free us from this insanity. Because we're all very slow. Like it is taking up so much, like of our brain, collective brain.
It is bad. Like how he's infested our brains. What's up?
Yeah,
yeah. I would also say that in terms of the big picture, like generally, people there is this sort of like hobby horse, particularly people on the right who like to bang the drum about free speech. Mm-hmm. And I think there are genuinely very difficult and thorny questions about how speech is moderated online, how it's moderated on social platforms. Generally, the people who are shouting about free speech have no interest in any of those questions. And Elon Musk is just a perfect example of that. That like, again, I think there's all kinds of difficult questions about how you would moderate speech on Twitter. He has no interest in that. He's just, you know, whatever his pet thing is at the moment, that's what, you know, all the remaining engineers at Twitter have to work on rather than like real serious policy.
Who do you guys think there at some point somebody's going to dramatize like this, the fall of Twitter and like Elon Musk, like this whole thing, hopefully in a limited series and not a movie, because I feel like the story is too wild and expansive. Who should play Elon Musk? That is the thought that's been on my mind lately.
That is good. You know, after Social Network was so good.
It was very good.
Right? That's the one on HBO, right? I'm mixing everybody.
No.
Well, you're thinking of Silicon Valley. Yeah.
Silicon Valley. That's what I mean. Mm-hmm. That was so good. It was so well done. I would love to see them come back now with all the craziness that's going on in tech. But who could play Elon Musk?
Just struck me.
I know.
Is Will Ferrell. I think
you want to go comedic.
I'm not even saying go comedic. I'm just saying this thing is hilarious. Everything Elon Musk does now is a comedy. So like Will Ferrell in like, you know, he has done a few serious movies, but like Will Ferrell would sort of like be able to tap into the like insane brain that Elon Musk is dealing with right now.
Do you guys have going to go Jude Law? And take it back to AI.
No, that's too nice. Too nice to Elon Musk. No, sir.
I feel like Steve Carell would be interesting because he's kind of, especially the character from The Office where he's just kind of like the only one laughing at his own jokes. And you're just kind of like, well, he's the same boss. Vibe. I guess we got to have to, that would be interesting.
I'm going
to
say Jeremy Strong.
Office, go OG Office. You got to get Ricky Gervais.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
That would be good, actually.
Ricky Gervais would be good. Any of the cringe humor people, but honestly, Jeremy Strong from Succession, who has done a good job of also living the cringe life, apparently. that's a good one. That's a good one, Anthony. But I do feel like people would tune in for the Elon Musk, the Twitter Files, limited series starring Will Ferrell. I think people would tune in just to be like, what is this? Should I watch this? I don't know. So Twitter did something else too. They open sourced a part of their algorithm, which is something Elon Musk was also complaining about for a while. And it turns out it's not actually much of it. They open sourced part of the algorithm that was used for the For You tab. So that's like their recommendation algorithm. We've seen a couple of revelations from this, but not actually much, right? Some people noticed that there were specific groups for Democrats and Republicans to kind of sort people into that. Elon Musk apparently had his own like specific category. So those specific things, he didn't know why that was there. And he was sort of like questioning this in real time. But Chris Sabel over at Engadget wrote a good piece, just kind of compiling things, trying to figure out like what we actually learned from this. Turns out not much. Turns out like a lot of the open source code out there is a very small part of what Twitter does. Doesn't actually like give us a full look at the company. And it's all like, it's a whole lot of nothing, like so much from Elon Musk's mouth these days. Like it is the thing he clamored for and doesn't actually give us much details. Have you guys looked at this or like the revelations from the open sourcing of the code?
I
looked at it a little bit, and it was interesting that it appeared that links were kind of, you would be dinged for having a link in there. Replies didn't count as much as retweets or likes. So that was kind of interesting. But I think, again, most of us in media have known forever, basically, that Twitter is not a super great driver of traffic. I mean, Facebook was back in the day. I don't know about nowadays as much. But like Twitter is basically just like, it's weird now, but like it was never a traffic driver. So it doesn't, I've always treated it as just like Seinfeld gifs and like sports rumors and stuff, a very like very casual approach to Twitter. But yeah, the actual open source, I guess he said he was going to do it and he did it. Kinda.
He did part of it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a gold star there.
We also saw that the Twitter is downranking posts related to the Ukraine crisis. So that's like a whole other thing.
Although it seemed like actually that might be specifically Twitter Spaces.
Twitter Spaces, yes.
But again, it's like very confusing and it's not totally clear what it means.
The why of it is all very confusing. Yeah. And I am also still shocked that Twitter Spaces are still up and running because I feel like that's a very complex part of the company. And we're waiting for pieces to fall off of Twitter and people are still hosting Spaces. And that seems to be going fine, I guess. Yeah. There was something else. Did you guys notice the Doge on Twitter this week?
I will say, as much as I like to complain about Elon Musk's Twitter, I thought that was fun. That was, you know what? Like, it was cute. It brought a smile to my face.
I mean, listen, I feel like he's ruining Shiba Inu's for all of us, but it is one of those things where like, oh, this guy just, he can just, he owns Twitter. He could just do this. He could just put the Dogecoin dog that he's also, he's been pumping Doge for a while and he's being sued by people around that. But he could just put the Dogecoin dog up on Twitter and we'll have to live with that.
And I mean, I think overall, it's just like all this stuff is a reminder that this is, that Twitter is now like control, you know, this weird pet, incredibly expensive pet project owned by this one guy. And it's just going to be whatever his weird preferences are, that's what's going to happen. And I, you know, it does actually seem like some interesting, if not particularly revelatory things came out of the open sourcing, but even when he makes gestures towards it, fundamentally, this is his pet project. Like, don't think of it as anything but that.
Yeah. Which I don't know if we fully, if Twit has fully had like a eulogy for Twitter, but I mean, for me personally, like it was a super useful tool for many, many years. Like it was my favorite social media platform for a reason. And I don't know if you guys have seen this, but there are a lot of media Twitter, a lot of like other reporters have been doing, were doing spaces like early on when Twitter took over ownership of like, oh my God, it's all falling apart. And isn't this really sad? And a lot of it was very navel-gazy, but also like, yeah, Twitter played a very big role in my life and my career. And it really does stink to see it being like turned into this tool, you know, for a billionaire who has no idea what to do with it other than troll people with Dogecoin pictures. So that's funny, I guess. I don't know. I will say
on the other side of that, I still see plenty of people just using Twitter as if nothing happened. I'm a huge sports fan. I still see plenty of sports supporters just tweeting their scoops. You know, guys talking about what happened last night in the game. So there still appears to be plenty of like ordinary use of Twitter, notwithstanding a lot of the folks getting upset over whatever Elon does this week. It's, you know, who's to say what happens in the future? Time will tell, I guess. But I still see like a critical mass of kind of like normal usage, so to speak. And to me, that's kind of like, that would be the canary. If those guys stop tweeting, if those guys stop talking about the bad ref call or things like that, if that goes away, then I'll be like, okay, maybe Twitter is dying. But for now, I still see a lot of that.
I'm seeing like a lot of media people moving over to Mastodon, and I'm kind of splitting my time and trying to like spend more time on Mastodon, but it is one of those things where it's like a lot of the voices I really liked on Twitter are just not there anymore. So it's starting to feel like more and more of a ghost town, but I'm sure specific niches like sports. Yeah. All the sports people are probably still using it just fine.
Right now, I feel like Mastodon is heavy tech because we got it right away. I never even made mine yet because I was like, no, Twitter's going to make it. It'll be all right. No, it's not. Oh, God, I called that one wrong. So
it's still good. It's still good. Yeah.
It's still there, but I'm with you. Like, I missed the part where Twitter, you know, was good. It was a good place to, you know, to share your stories and, you know, connect with companies and apps and things like that. And now, yes, it's a little bit, you know, psycho, but I still use it just because, like, if you're not calling your own shots on Twitter, somebody else might call them for you. So, but I don't put the effort and time I used to in it because it's just not going to, the outcome is not going to be there. So, it is a very strange place. But it's almost like one of those things, if you ignore it long enough, you go to pick those up to put them in the laundry and you're like, whoa, what did I do? I never leave that over there again, right?
Yeah.
So you got to do that. You can't.
What kind of funk just grew on this thing
if
you
right,
Twitter
exactly.
for a while? And it is funkier every week. And it makes me sad because I started in like 2008. I started a movie podcast like way back then. And thanks to Twitter, we were able to bring on directors and guests and film critics. And like, that was a big part of like how my podcast grew. This is a big part of like how media people kind of evolved and worked over the last decade or more, actually 15 years now. So
I think Twitter helped make regular people start paying attention to the tech space a little more. Mm-hmm. You know, before it was just us, right? We were all kind of sort of talking to each other, right? And then around the time of like, right when we were starting to slow down and we were getting closed, right? We basically evolved to Engadget completely. And that was about the time that the general public was starting to come in, which is part of the reason why I think AOL made the decision to shut down TWA and like stick us all together, was because more people were going to come in and they weren't going to go to two sites because the phone was getting big enough that it wasn't a Mac site and a PC site and then a random phone site. It was like everybody.
In retrospect, probably not the best decision, AOL. I feel like a lot of stuff. Yeah.
It cost me a job.
That's a whole separate episode.
A whole separate thing. yep.
Yeah, but I think that was really at the time that I started to hear some of my regular friends, like, you know, talk about, oh, I heard this on, you know, Engadget. I heard this on The Verge. I'm like, what do you know about Engadget or The Verge or, you know, back then Gizmodo or whatever? And it was that, what was it, the iPhone 4S, the one that got away in the bar? And that's when normal people started
playing
paying attention.
iPhone 4, yeah.
Yeah, iPhone 4. Okay, that was when I think regular people started paying attention, and it kind of grew from there. And then I agree with you now. It's very sad to what it is now. Yep. It's like seeing one of your friends from high school that's just,
you know, exactly. It's like, oh, you look at their Facebook. It's like, oh, no, you've fallen far. This is very sad.
Although, again, to be fair to Elon, who, again, I think is doing a terrible job and, and is ruining Twitter in a lot of ways. Twitter was having a lot of trouble for that. And Twitter was a lot less fun for me even before Elon bought it. Some of that is just, you know, I'm 40 now. I was 25 when I got on Twitter, like the amount of time
those
I have
glorious to just, like, days of our 20s and on
Twitter, to just like say dumb stuff online is less. But I think there were also, you know, when Twitter became a public company and there was like pressure to grow it, and then they're like just cycling through all these different things that will save Twitter, whether it was spaces or video or all these things, you know, it was clearly something they were struggling, and that was why Elon was able to buy them. So it's absolutely not like it was great. Elon bought it, and then that's what destroyed it. It was that, like, Elon buying it was like the end of this, or like the was just the next step in this like death spiral or whatever.
I am mad at everybody, like the Twitter leadership at the time, and Jack Dorsey too, like the people who were like quick to cash out because Twitter was kind of flailing, and Elon was just like, hey, I'm gonna overpay for this thing, you know. Yeah.
And remember, the thing that's really hilarious to me now is remember that Twitter sued to force Elon to buy it.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't like Elon wanted to back out.
Yeah. I mean,
whether he did or whether it was just a negotiating tactic to lower the price, I don't know. But like, there was a period where he's like, I'm going to walk away. And Twitter's like, no, you're doing it.
Yeah. Oh, man. We are truly living in the dumbest timeline. I feel like whenever we talk about Twitter and Elon Musk news, like, it's just a reminder of that. It is, it's not great. You know who we don't talk about very much these days is Meta. Remember Meta? Or at least the Metaverse. I'm trying to think of like much news that's been happening around Meta these days. And I guess that's like one good thing about Twitter kind of soaking up a lot of the social media controversy side of things. But I mean, there were a couple stories we're looking at, like Meta is potentially considering a political ad ban in the EU because of new regulations coming up there. There's news analysis showing like, hey, people are benefiting quite a bit from Twitter, except I believe the news showed that new posts with news links get less than 3% of Facebook use. So it is funny that this post that they put out there showing like how useful Facebook is, Meta is for, you know, for actual news sources and their actual news spreading is not actually true anymore. I feel like it was a lot more. And there was a story earlier this month about Clearview AI admitting that scraped 30 billion images from Facebook and other social media sites to give them to cops. And remember Clearview AI, that's the company that was working on facial recognition software. They licensed it to police, and we're kind of all on a basically perpetual police lineup thanks to this company. So that's the Meta report. I don't know if you guys have any feelings about like where Meta is or where it could be going, because it does seem like nobody's talking about the metaverse anymore, thanks to AI.
I think Meta kind of reminds me of Looney Tunes, when Pick Your Random character had both hands and both feet blocking the water coming through the wall.
Uh-huh.
And then another water would break through the wall, and they got to move in there all of a sudden, just juggling really fast. I think after their initial debacle, they've been doing that the entire time, and there's not enough hands to block all of the holes in the wall. They had the perfect opportunity when Elon started just messing up Twitter to come in and be like, remember us? We're sorry. We'll take we'll you be back. Better. We went and fixed everything. We're going to be better. And they kind of hosed that too. It was working for a minute, but they just couldn't manage to just be right. So in a way, I'm going to talk about a person who kind of fits the personality of Facebook, and they stole his name, Meta World Peace. Hands down, one of the best defenders ever in the game, one of the best ballers in the game, but he could never just behave and do right. And if he could just get out of his own way and behave and do right, he'd be definitely top five, you know, dead or alive. But he could not do right. I feel like Meta, first he should have sued them for stealing his name. But then
there was another company called Meta before
there was
VR headsets. Yeah,
that's 100%
true. I demoed that VR headset or AR headset at the time.
But they're living up to Mr. Artest. They're him in, like, as a company. If Ron Artest was a company, it'd be Facebook.
It is. There is probably like some sort of like weird, like dark comedy to make about like social media over the past 5 years too, because so much of it was Facebook basically chasing everybody, right? Like copying Snapchat, copying Twitter whenever they could too. Pretty much everybody. Like you had to bring in all the new features to Instagram. Facebook seems so desperate for so long, and then the whole metaverse thing was just like Zuckerberg like putting his foot down, being like, "This is the future." And I don't, have you guys spent any time in the metaverse doing metaverse meetings or doing like the meta demos that have been out there?
I played Horizon Worlds around Christmas time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't for me, and I'm a huge gamer. Like I've played Lord knows an inordinate amount of World of Warcraft and like, so I'm like primed to like enjoy online communities. And it was just kind of boring. The graphics were bad. I was like, why would I play with this? There's no compelling reason to be here actually. So I don't. It's so funny that like every, you know, Facebook Meta is talking about the metaverse, and then all of a sudden everyone's talking about AI, and they're like, oops, yeah. Oh, it just kind of like the ground shifted completely underneath them, and no one. Yeah, I don't know. I don't see a whole lot of regular. I'm at Consumer Reports. I don't know that I see a whole lot of everyday consumer interest in like VR stuff or like the metaverse. I will say that I do see a lot of activity. Facebook Marketplace has, I think, basically replaced Craigslist from back.
Sure.
In the day.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
You know, people use the groups for like, you know, again, I just moved. I see people use Facebook groups to talk about Arizona and stuff going on, restaurant recommendations. And so there does appear to be like a lot of folks like active on the less exciting aspects of faith. It just kind of feels
it's still a decent social network, right? Like
it is,
you can find most people there. You can find your high school friends there or the people you hated in high school. So the push away from it just seemed funny. So I did, over at Engadget, I've covered Horizon Worlds. I covered like the virtual meeting stuff and it was kind of cool, but I will tell you guys like what I did, one of those things, and Zuckerberg like piped in his little metaverse avatar, and he was sitting right next to my little avatar.
Oh.
And it was a weird thing of like, oh, am I sitting next to Mark Zuckerberg? Is this weird? It is weird because like if I turn my head and I was wearing the Oculus Quest 2, it would be my avatar staring at him. It's like, oh, that's bad. That's not good. We shouldn't do that. That's you know, socially not great. So I was like trying not to hold the controllers badly too, so my arms weren't doing weird things. And if you go look at footage from that, which is some of that is in the Engadget piece and in other sites pieces because they got like recorded footage, my hands are just doing like crazy gymnast motions because the MetaQuest hand tracking is so bad. Like, or at least the motion tracking didn't understand what I was trying to do when I put the controllers down. It like lost tracking and just went crazy. So, you know, that was his time to show off like what you could do with metaverse meetings. And it is cool. I actually do like taking meetings in the metaverse, but nobody's going to buy VR headsets just for that. You know, it's kind of a weird thing, but we're also all waiting for Apple to talk about their thing. Right. So is the metaverse completely dead? I don't, are you guys anticipating like whatever Apple is going to debut at WWDC?
As a diehard Apple person, I have both. I have reservations about it, and yet I'm interested to see what the way that we do it, right? I'm an ex-Apple employee. I should just say that right away.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But one of the things to me that even during the AI conversation, I'm like, yo, Apple has been like completely hiding from the AI conversation. And I feel like when they decide to come in, they're going to kick in the door, wave in the 4-4. Like Biggie. I don't know how, I don't know why, but whatever they do,
it's gonna be super powered Siri. That's what it has to be, right? With like GPT-5 level smarts and like it'll be the smartest thing in the world. That's the only way Apple could make it good. Because Siri right now is awful.
Or they'll just stay out of it completely.
You can't do that.
But that's exactly. So this is what I've been going to. And then the other thing, same with you know, we've been talking about Apple's AR headsets for a while. I feel like you remember when what was it? Ming Chi Kuo would always talk about Apple TV, like we're going to get a physical, you know, TV like the one back there, and it's going to have Apple TV built in. Yo, MC is still not out yet, so
I'm sure they tested it. Like I'm sure Apple played with it.
Yeah, I can neither. What is that? Agree or
confirm or deny.
I can't speak on that. But yes, it is definitely interesting to see. But already the rumor mill is like, oh, it's going to be $3,000. And it's like, they're not going to come out with a $3,000 headset if the competition is $200.
Do you figure, if that's the market, right? And it's like, it's interesting, like, because I feel like Meta is playing one game and Apple's like, okay, where is this market going to be in 5 years? You know, how do we prepare for that? $3,000 pair of like VR or augmented reality glasses that are good for developers, because how much does a Mac Pro cost? You know, like a Mac Pro starts at 5,000 plus, you know, like that is pro grade hardware, not meant for everybody. I make fun of Apple pricing all the time. There is the studio monitor.
I know, I yell at you every time.
The studio monitor with the $1,000 stand. Are you kidding me?
Okay, I'll tell you why. Yeah. This is funny. I'll explain this.
Please.
Finally,
please.
So people can let it go.
Uh-huh.
Do you know who builds the Bugatti Veyron?
No.
Volkswagen.
Uh-huh.
They build the Veyron as a proof of concept to get all the research and development, and the people that have the money to buy that basically pay for the R&D. They pay for the proof of concept, and then now they can take that and bring it back. Nissan builds some of the dopest GTP cars on the planet, so that your Nissan that you have to carry your children's around in has amazing anti-lock braking system that was invented at my college in Japan. I was with the kids. I wasn't in the class, but I used to stalk them because I thought it was so cool that they were building GTP car in the middle of a university. But a lot of that technology has made it down. So those crazy products that everyone loves to make fun of are twofold. That's the proof of concept so that you can get it down to an everyday person. And not
so that's the VR headset you're saying? Or
if they come out with a $3,000 VR headset, it's going to be built for those of us bleeding edges to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll whittle it down to where the general people can get at it. And then it's not so crazy anymore.
The tech is also...
The reason why the Hermes watch existed is so that we could get Ultra today. It's higher than the others, and it's a very particular crowd.
I disagree, but
and
okay,
it's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
But also, celebrities were really starting to jump onto the Apple train, so it was a good play. It wasn't intended for any of us to go and buy an Hermes or a Gold Edition. It was intended for Beyonce and Jay-Z and everybody who bought gold editions or Hermes editions.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't hurt Apple to do those things, but those were vanity products, right? Like the Hermes Apple Watch was functionally no better than the intro.
No, not at all. But it proved that somebody would pay for. So I believe the function was it proved that certain people will pay more if it hits a switch. And I think that's what I meant by the Ultra.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like it's the push on phones, like the iPhone Pro getting to close to $1,500 in many configurations, where it's like, phones aren't just $500 anymore, right? So it's like, I feel like Apple has seen like people just want to pay for that. Doc, I thought you were going to try to excuse $1,000 monitor stand.
It's there to get an idea of, you know, the kind of people that play. Now, also, you have to remember every company, every store, everywhere, somewhere has a product that's just kind of like crazy, right? Remember the Serendipity like $1,000 dessert? Like it exists because that's what gets people to talk about your restaurant, right?
Yeah.
The TV places, the production houses that will actually buy those, they don't care because it's all
they
part
have
of
arms.
The budget.
They have arms to mount those monitors on. Yeah.
Right. You know what I'm saying? So they'll spend money on stuff like that because it's just part of the budget, you know?
It is.
It was silly.
It's one of those things where I'm like, I can give Apple praise for certain things that they do. Like I think some things can be, you know, cheaper. Like I think the iPhone SE is a good play. I think like a lot of, you know, there are a lot of things that can be great plays and inexpensive and good deals. But then we see things like that monitor stand and it still makes me so angry, Doc. I'm so mad at it. But okay. I don't think the metaverse is dead yet, but it's certainly like whatever Meta was trying to get at probably is not going to be coming anytime soon. But we'll stay tuned, folks. Like we're going to be keeping an eye on like the Apple stuff, whatever's there. Honestly, I hope I'm going to get to go to Dub Dub and check this thing out in person. But we will be right back Let's move on to another ad from Leo.
Hello, everybody. Leo here. I know I'm not here, but I am here right now to tell you about our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Tech, ZipRecruiter. They want me to do that because we use ZipRecruiter, and I know intimately how great ZipRecruiter is. Whether you're starting a new business, whether you're growing a business, if you want to be successful, you need the most talented people on your team. A company's made of the people you hire, and that's where ZipRecruiter comes in. Right now, you can try it free, ZipRecruiter.com/twit. We don't have openings very often here, but when we do, it's always a crisis, right? Oh, no, we got to work extra hours to fill in the hole. It's going to take us forever to find a great employee, right? And Lisa will go, I can tell you it's happened many times. At breakfast, she'll say, oh, no. This happened when Ashley quit from Continuity. She got a better job closer to home, right? So we love her. She gave us 2 weeks' notice. That was nice. But 2 weeks is pretty quick to find a replacement for somebody as great as Ashley, right? So Lisa, that morning, goes to ZipRecruiter.com/twit, types in the job opening. Immediately, with a click of a mouse, that job opening goes to more than 100 other job boards plus social networks, reaches out the widest net. And then the thing we loved about ZipRecruiter is she's not going to get phone calls. Her inbox is not going to get flooded. It all goes into the ZipRecruiter interface where it's very easy to screen out people. You can have yes, no questions, multiple choice, even essay questions, automatically screen out people who don't have the right qualifications. You can reformat all of the resumes so it's very easy to scan them. And it makes it very easy to rank all your candidates and pick the right one fast. But I have to say, ZipRecruiter does one more thing that's really miraculous. ZipRecruiter has millions of resumes on file because people come to ZipRecruiter looking for work, right? So they scan through those looking for candidates that match the qualifications, your requirements for the job you've got opening. And then they'll find those candidates and send them to you and say, here's some people we think would match. You look at the resumes and you invite the people you want. Now, I have to tell you, when you invite somebody to apply for your job, that's like the golden ticket. I mean, they are so happy to be invited. They show up, they do the interviews, all of that stuff. It's a really great way to begin that process. And then, of course, you get a wonderful person. And we did. That's how we met Viva, who replaced Ashley and is wonderful. Thank you, ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter also will let you do things to your posting with like little labels that speak to things like job flexibility. They may say things like remote training provided or urgent if you're and you're always urgent when you're trying to fill a position, right? It really helps your job stand out. It's just one more way ZipRecruiter makes it easier to find the right person fast. Let ZipRecruiter fill all your roles with the right candidates. Like us, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. For us, it's usually before lunch. It's usually in a couple of hours. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address. Try ZipRecruiter for free. And if you use this address, that's good for us because then they know you saw it here. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. ZipRecruiter.com/TWIT. I can vouch for it. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, don't any of you quit because we're on vacation, okay? Stay here, at least until we get back. Now it's back to This Week in Tech. Thanks, guys.
Oh, I hope he's having some good food over wherever he is in Europe right now. I've lost track of Leo. I think he was on a ship at some point. So hopefully Leo's having a good time, but we've still got some news to talk about here. We got a great panel, too. Nicholas De Leon from Consumer Reports, Doc Rock, YouTube Master, Anthony Ha from ENIAC Ventures. What's up, everybody? How are you guys doing? We're at the tail end of the show. I know at least one of you is a first-timer here. I hope everyone's good, got your news stamina up. Let's move on to some news from Google, because Google is, again, not as much in the news as some of these other companies. How many files do you guys think you have in your Google Drive? Do you have 5 million? Do you have over 5 million files in your Google Drive?
I sure don't.
Feels like a lot, but...
Seems like a lot. I mean, Google Drive has been around for a long time, and I think people on Reddit and Google's own support site, like, were noticing that they just couldn't add a certain amount of files anymore. Google has announced that they've reduced that or removed that limit entirely. Just a really interesting thing to think about, like, given how long Google Drive has been there. Have you guys been using Google Drive and Gmail, I guess, since they've been out?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember reporting the launch and being very excited to be.
Yeah.
Right. So, you remember back when you had to get like invites from somebody and then people were selling them on eBay?
I spent $5 on eBay for a Gmail invite. So right, that is how I got it.
That's so funny. I got my first Google, I got my Gmail invite from Kevin Rose. Mm-hmm. And at that time, like I was just, you know, in the chat first, like, you know, he's like, guys, we got five to give away. And they're doing like a show. It wasn't even live. It was like,
we were so excited for Gmail.
Oh my God.
Changed the world.
I remember being so furious at whatever Google employee was also named Anthony Ha because he had claimed Anthony Ha at gmail.com. So I couldn't do it, which was, I'm still angry about.
I'm sorry. Maybe one day you will be able to chase him down and reclaim that email address. I don't know.
I'll give you, wherever you are, I'll give you $5 for it.
Yeah. Anthony Ha out there.
You guys remember too, the thing that made Gmail amazing was you got 25 gigs of space.
Was it 25 or was it like two?
I think it might have been like it was two. Actually,
it was two gigabytes. Was two.
You're correct.
Right.
You're correct.
This was like 2005, 2006. I was out of college and working in IT, and like it was perfect time to be like, oh, this is cool as hell because I can talk to people about this. Like, also the idea of like web-based email was still a little like fresh and new, right? Because all we had was Hotmail and a couple
even
others.
IMAP was still.
Yeah,
it wasn't new, but as far as being used by a majority of the population, actually, it wasn't even the majority. It was the beginning of it was like we were using IMAP. Yes. Other people were still on POP and wondering why do I check my email here and it's missing
bring all these
here?
Acronyms back to me, Doc. Like the things I used to have to set up. It's like, oh, why do you want IMAP over POP 3? And what about my Exchange server? How do you connect all those things together? Man. It is wild to think. And now
actually, Gmail launched in 2004, and it was 1 gigabyte, and it was April 1st. I remember reading the Slashdot.
Okay. Wow.
Slashdot story is still live. So I remember reading this when I was, I guess I was technically still in high school when it launched. Yep. But everyone was like, a gigabyte? This is obviously
a gigabyte.
Was that real?
Was that the
this
private launch? News. Because for some reason, I have 2 gigabytes embedded in my brain.
Yeah, I have 2 in my
head. Maybe when it was like first announced. Yeah, I don't remember the private public.
Yeah. It was in beta for forever, but man, that was just that like changed the world, right? And like after Gmail, I just stopped configuring email clients altogether, right? Like I guess post 2008, like when I left IT and when I moved to New York, if you're just using Gmail for email, why would you configure that in your like desktop client? Just go to the website.
Yeah, okay, right? Found
it's
it.
Much easier.
April 1st, 2005.
Yes,
Google increased it to 2 gigabytes by Juan Carlos Perez. He wrote this article. Is that bananas, people?
Yeah.
Absolutely bananas. And you remember at that time, if you were a Mac user, if your Eudora or Outlook database, right, because we had the PST file, if it got to around 2 gigs, it started to get really like messed up and wouldn't really work, right? And so it was a big deal that you had 2 gigabytes and it would actually work.
Oh, man. And the idea in Google Drive just seemed like this limitless storage box for you to like share whatever you want, legal stuff, illegal stuff. I'm not gonna judge. CNET does point out that Google was kind of unique compared to OneDrive, Dropbox, and other sites. Like they actually had a file number limit, which was like irrespective of your whatever storage you were paying for. So that limit they started rolling out a drive limit in February. And I think that's when people started noticing this restriction. Just a weird thing. And it seems like you're Google. You're worried about people having too many small files in their drive folders. I feel like you've got more pressing things to worry about, Google. Google's worried about AI. Google's worried about Bard. And because of this, apparently, too, they're going to have fewer micro kitchens in their office. So sorry, Googlers. No free lunch. No more free lunches for you, thanks to AI, I guess.
Wait, what was the actual rationale?
That is the reporting I have seen. I'm looking at a post here, a story here from Washington Post. They haven't said an actual like reasoning, but all we know is like Google is focusing so much on Bard and so many other things. So they are cutting micro kitchens that populate their office with 3 snacks, cereal, espresso, seltzer water, stuff like that. They're also laying off a ton of people too, right? So Google is in like a major cost-cutting mode right now. So is Microsoft. So is pretty much every major tech company.
We talked about this on MacBreak Weekly. We talked about Apple doing it.
Yep. Apple doing it too. I think Tim Cook like famously took a major pay cut, right? as part of this, or like wasn't getting a major pay. Yes. So,
although he's still making tens of millions of dollars. Yeah. He'll be okay.
He'll be okay. He has stock. He will be perfectly fine. But yeah, that was the thing. And also hearing that news compared to like what we've seen from some Japanese companies too, like Nintendo being like, we'll just pay you guys more. Things are hard out here. We understand you employees. Here's more money instead of taking away your jobs and your Christmas. You. So that's something, man. Japan.
You know what's really interesting is to think about, like, during the time being in tech so long, I never thought we'd get to the point where we're talking about the Fang, if you will, trying to cut costs. That part just seems absolutely bananas to me because, you know, back when I was at corporate, the lavish, just random things that would happen. I remember going into the cafeteria one day and like, oh, we have a sushi bar now.
Yep.
And the chef, we've flown in from Japan, you know, and it was cool. I speak Japanese, right? So it was cool to go to the counter and order my food in Japanese. And he was so excited to like be able to talk to some employee in Japanese. And it's just weird. I never thought we'd be talking about these guys cutting costs. And it does seem a little silly because, yeah, they're still the richest companies out there. So
for sure. Like they are still, I have not seen Google's earnings. I mean, everybody was worried about profits slowing. I don't know if profits have actually dipped for Google. Anthony, you may be paying closer attention to that sort of thing. But I know like Microsoft like was seeing they have been so high in cloud earnings for a while, and that dipped a little bit and everybody freaked out. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. But another indignity to Google employees. They may be issued a Chromebook instead of a MacBook the next time they get a new computer. So I find that just hilarious. Not the biggest Chromebook fan in the world. But yeah, that is like so many different things. Cost-cutting measures all over the place. And related to like all of this too, related to the layoffs, Google workers in London also staged a walkout protest over this stuff too. So it is very weird. Like, I'm sure we're going to look at Google and see like, oh yeah, their revenues are still like killing it.
I mean, yeah, I think that it's easy also to focus on sort of some of the more kind of fun headlines, like mm-hmm. the micro kitchens, Chromebooks instead of a MacBook.
Yeah.
Although I would definitely struggle with that.
I think many would. Yeah.
The challenge, I guess the bigger question, and this is also to Doc's point, right, is like, it's not just the companies could spend lavishly because, yes, they were, you know, pampering their engineers and whatever, mm-hmm. but it was also about the idea that they were doing well enough and Wall Street investors were impressed with them enough that they could be like, hey, we're going to invest in these projects and they're not going to pay off for 10 years. And we're just but we think it's important for where the future is going. And we can spend billions of dollars on this. And, you know, sometimes they were right, sometimes they were wrong. But I think that if you go to a situation where, you know, Google, Facebook, you know, Fang has to be just super, super hyper focused on like, what does the quarterly earnings report look like? Have we cut costs enough that like the analysts will be happy with us? That is, I think, that's just a very, very different environment. And I think that really changes the culture of these companies and their ability mm-hmm. to, you know, build for the future and to think long term.
I almost wonder how much of this is a response to people just saying like they want to work remotely more too. Like you're not going to have as many office perks at all. Although Google and a lot of other companies are trying to get people back into the office at least part of the week too. So this is a weird push and pull thing happening over on the Google side of things. It kind of is funny to me to think that going to Chromebooks is kind of a downsizing for Google employees too. But also now everybody needs a MacBook. So I get it. I totally get it. It is also weird as somebody, I used to have to, you know, figure out the IT purchasing plan for a small college. And like, I took that seriously. It was like, okay, I want my users to have the good stuff that they can actually use that will be functional for them. It's going to be hard to justify Chromebooks just for some people. But I guess if you work at Google, that's most of your work, right? You probably don't need too many other apps.
Just imagine like being at the Google office and suddenly having a MacBook is a status symbol. Because I imagine there's some people that they're going to be like, no, I'm keeping this computer. Get the hell away from me.
I have to make art. I have to do all sorts of stuff. The Chromebook is not enough. Hey, I love the idea of Chromebooks. I love the idea of cheap Chromebooks. But man, when they started getting expensive, when they started becoming premium computers, I just had to raise my hand and call shenanigans on some of that stuff. Okay, moving on from Google. What do you guys feel about E3? I don't know if Twit has talked about this yet, but this is something we have been talking about in Engadget quite a bit, because we were trying to figure out, like, hey, E3 is the big video game trade show, you know, typically happens annually in LA, although I forget if there was actually a live one last year, and after, you know, in 2020 it was canceled because of the pandemic. They've been virtual for a little while, as I recall. But E3 2023 is officially canceled, and to me, this signals like a huge sea change for the video game industry and like the media landscape around gaming too. Any thoughts on this before we dive further into
it? I will say video games were the first kind of tech thing that I cared about as a kid. I remember reading about E3 in GamePro and Nintendo Power. It sounded like Disney. It was like, oh my God, I have to get to E3. I was lucky enough to report on E3 for a couple of years for various publications. Yeah, and I agree. It feels like this is, you know, they haven't said that E3 is canceled forever, but this year is canceled. And, you know, the reasons why are there's multiple. You know, all the publishers have their own Twitch streams, Nintendo, you know, Nintendo Directs. They don't really need to pay the ESA a site fee to tell the world about the new Zelda game or to tell the world about the new Assassin's Creed or whatever it may be. So I do think that the idea of kind of like a centralized trade show to show trailers for new games is kind of, you know, especially if you're like cost cutting or like looking at like, do I really just spend all that money and fly these people out? It's like, it doesn't make a ton of sense when you can get just as much engagement for free on Twitch or YouTube or whatever the case may be, or hosting your own event where you're kind of like what Apple does. But Apple doesn't go to Macworld anymore. They have their own shows. You know, they control the production from A to Z. So if you're Electronic Arts, if you're Microsoft and Xbox, at most, why don't we just have our own show where we control everything and we can keep the costs to where we like them? So yeah, it does feel, you know, as a rapidly aging gamer, it does feel a little sad that it's all like, oh man, E3 is like, it used to be really cool. Like, it's hard to, you know, if you're 18 years old today, you probably don't understand what E3 was.
Kids these days are so spoiled. They have a perfectly realistic Mario movie that they can go see that looks exactly like
which
the
is
Mario.
So yesterday it was awesome. I was great. There was enough like fan out. Service in there to make me happy. But yeah, it does feel sad that E3, like the shiny event, our Oscars, our like big event of the year, is now like kind of going away.
It's kind of depressing. Anthony,
you know what's funny? What's funny, Nicholas, is I was going to say, to me, one of the saddest moments of my life in tech was the day that we're all walking out of Moscone at the very last Macworld. Now, the last three were already, Apple wasn't even coming.
Yeah,
it was mostly all of us guys from, you know, Gizmodo and Gadget to, you know, all the other sites out there, Mac OS Ken, Merlin Man, you know, all of the top guys, Brett Terpstra, everybody. We would all get together, hang out, enjoy each other's company, see new tech that was coming out, enjoy all of the 1,300 cases. That was the joke at the time, was it's like, you know, case fest. And it was like, sad to see it go, but we'll be all right. And I swear to you, ever since then, we get together about the same time every year and start messaging each other, man, I miss you, bro. I wish I could see you. Or, you know, it's kind of funny. And, you know, Luria, the aforementioned Callie Lewis, like I talk to her literally every day. And, you know, Macworld was when, you know, we would see each other in real life and you know, get to hang out. So that part of it is going to suck. But you are so right. They could do so much better with their own. And once, you know, Google I.O. and, you know, Facebook's event and then again, you know, WWDC has already proven to everybody that you should kind of just run your own event. If you're big enough. So where it hurts is it hurts the small guys, the guys that are creating things to move the industry along. And a lot of companies, this is so crazy now, a lot of companies come from that last back wall where the tiny little small companies. I work for one of those companies now that used to be on the back wall. They made a cool plugin for printers called Printopia. And now we're Ecamm Live and, you know, Skype Call Recorder and one of the best live streaming platforms. But I remember when those guys were teenagers with the little table in the corner. And after I worked with them and I got to meet them again, I was like, man, I swear I met these guys before. I just happened to be cleaning the Macworld like business card box. And I found Glenn's card. And I was like, Glenn, I did interview back in like 2013. I interviewed you about like Printopia or eyeglasses. And it's funny that I work there with them now. And so many good companies came from that small, you know, Backwall, Spigen, Anchor, Belkin even, you know, they were just mm-hmm. the tiny guys in the corner, and now they're phenoms, you know?
It does feel like we're losing something, right? So, like, Nicholas, like, I'm right there with you. Like, my formative tech moment was I was probably 5 years old, and I saw Super Mario Brothers 1 at my cousin's house, and I was like, oh, like, yeah. Lightning struck my brain, and I was like, oh, everything is different after this, so... I remember like crying and wailing and like not wanting to leave that room at all. And I got an NES shortly after. But yeah, games were always my first tech love. So I also read about E3 in GamePro as a kid. It was like in the 90s, be like, oh, this is the coolest thing. I'd love to go here at some point. In high school, I was an electronic sales associate at Office Max, which made me industry. I was like, oh, man, I was just excited about the possibility of even potentially getting to go. Never actually went in high school, no. But yeah, I enjoyed going to the show. Like, it was really cool to like see these events, see some of the booths. I went shortly after the Switch launch, so I saw like a whole bunch of stuff. And ahead of like Mario Odyssey, Nintendo had like a crazy booth for that. It is like, it's an incredible thing, but it's also a weird thing because it is a trade show. It's a place made for business deals. It's not really the place where you always go to see the shiny new things. It's a weird thing. It's a very strange thing because, yeah, all the companies can do their own stuff now. And also, you've got PAX. You've got other ways. You've got the summer game show. You've got Jeff Keighley, like, doing his own shows and premiering trailers all the time and being really, like, buddy-buddy with developers. So the landscape is just so different. Like, there is no room for E3 anymore, sort of. And I understand why. I'm just sad about it, personally. Yeah.
Same, yeah.
Yep. Anthony, any thoughts? I don't know if E3 was on your radar at all.
No, I mean, it was definitely, I had the same experience as you guys as a mm-hmm. kid, where I would read about it a lot and think about going. I think that once I got into writing about tech professionally, the gaming world was sort of so separate that I didn't mm-hmm. really spend a lot of time there. But my sense of it was also that it was like a beast, right? It was just so big and it's
so big,
interesting.
So many people. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting to wonder about, you know, like you guys were talking about, there's so many other game events on the calendar. I imagine others will come up as sort of mm-hmm. filling that vacuum for E3. But where is there still room for like the giant trade show that like is just a giant convention center that yeah. you have to like, you get tired, you know, just walking from one end to the other.
I feel like that's Gamescom. So that's the thing in Cologne, Germany, which is bigger than E3. Like Gamescom is freaking okay. huge. And I've done Gamescom. I did 1 year and that was a horrible trip, but Gamescom itself was kind of cool. But yeah, that is a thing that still exists, I think. And that was always like a better place for European and Asian developers to kind of join up and talk to each other. So right. I think that'll still be the thing, but I will miss E3. E3 like represented so much of gaming for me, but yeah, things are just so, so different now. Let's head back to Leo for another sponsor.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for letting me barge in here for just a moment. I flew all the way to Africa. I'm in Tangier, Morocco, and I kind of did it to make a point. Our sponsor today is Miro. Look, employees these days are no longer coming to the office. Some of them are working from home. Some of them are working from elsewhere in the world. But there's one great way to keep everybody on the same page and productive, and that's Miro. Miro is a whiteboard solution, but that doesn't do it justice. Miro is whatever you need it to be, a place for everybody working on a project to come together, to put their ideas, to keep up with what's going on. Even if they work in different time zones, they could see what's actually happening with Miro. And Miro can be used in so many different ways. Use it to time your Zoom calls, for icebreakers, for brainstorming. Use it to design a new product. Miro integrates with all sorts of applications. We use it with Zapier and a variety of other applications, Google Docs and Slack. But you can make Miro your own, and that's the beauty of Miro. Miro is great for anybody who's working with a team, and any team, no matter where they are, anywhere in the world. That's the beauty of Miro. Miro's infinite collaborative whiteboard gives product teams a perpetual space where they can simply drag and drop insights and data. Nothing's lost, nothing's forgotten. Miro covers pretty much any possible use case in the world, so users can build visual assets, present findings, run brainstorms with cross-functional teams. I think Miro's the coolest thing ever. Mike and I have been using it for our show, Ask the Tech Guys, and it's a great way for us, even in different continents, to stay in touch and plan together. Miro gives your team the chance to always stay connected to real-time information. no matter where they are. It gives project managers and product leads a bird's eye view of the whole project to ensure nothing slips through the cracks. Be part of it. More than a million users who join Miro every month. And you know what they say, and I think our experience has been the same. Miro saves, on average, 80 hours a year per user. That's like 2 weeks, enough time to take a little vacation to maybe Morocco. So, folks, look, get your first three boards for free. Start working better. Miro.com/podcast. Miro.com/podcast. We love Miro. It is a great way to work together to collaborate no matter where you are. In fact, for a great idea about what Miro can do, visit the Miroverse. There's lots of sample boards there. Get your first boards free. Your first three boards free at Miro.com/podcast. Miro.com/podcast. Well, you know how to spell podcast. All right. Leo Laporte from Morocco signing off. I'll be back in a couple of weeks and I'll tell you more about Miro. Back to you, Devendra.
Thanks, Leo. I am so jealous. And let's check out what else is happening on the Twit Network this week.
Or if that's an example of what folks can look forward to when they're trying to get involved.
Sure, I can highlight a few of the...
Oh. Sorry, yes. I fell off the chair.
Wheels are broken, huh?
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a chronic problem for Mr. Pat.
Previously on Twit. Hands on Mac.
It's time to take a look at some keyboard shortcuts for text selection on macOS. Stay tuned.
All about Android.
You know, those iOS folks have their AirDrop. And you were wondering, wouldn't it be nice if Android had something more like AirDrop? I mean, we already kind of have it, which has sort of been around for a bit nearby Share. It's kind of taken another step to be more of a proper AirDrop, you know, competitor with a recent launch of a Windows 10 beta, and it will allow you to share files between your Android devices and your Windows PC.
This week in Google.
I said, I need a name that sounds like Jeff Jarvis, but sounds evil, like an evil twin. And here is what the AI compiled. It said, how about Jex Javros? It has a similar sound to Jeff Jarvis, but with a more sinister and menacing twist. Jex Javros.
Well, Jex, I think, sounds perfectly bashing.
This is your brain.
Jex Javros.
This is your brain on Twit. Any questions?
See, every time now I've got this little Jex Javros sitting on my shoulder, who, depending on what words I'm using.
On one shoulder.
Yeah, Jeff is like, exactly.
look at your tagline, Jeff. Yep. There we go.
And we're back. And you know what, guys? We were just talking about the Super Mario Brothers movie. Nicholas, it sounds like you've seen it already. Anthony, yes. Doc, have you guys seen it yet?
Not yet. Yeah.
I went to see Dungeons and Dragons instead.
Also a good choice.
Which I highly recommend.
Yeah. That movie. We are spoiled for great movies right now, guys. John Wick 4, all this stuff. Yeah. Just want to point out, I think a lot of us expected the Super Mario Brothers movie to be big, but it is apparently a phenomenon. It is huge. Over its 5-day opening weekend, it raked in $146 million domestically, which makes it the biggest release of the year. And the global debut, the global box office, is $377.5 million. I've read globally that is the largest debut, the largest opening for an animated movie. But I'm seeing conflicting stats there. That's a lot of money. It's doing pretty well, certainly better than the live action Mario Brothers movie from, 91, 92. So
I remember that, yeah.
I saw that as a kid and it broke my heart. And I saw this one is like, okay, not perfect. I reviewed it over at Engadget, but it is certainly the animation is beautiful. I think it's funny enough. And I think Jack Black as Bowser, perfect. It was a great choice. Not all the casting is good. I'm not a huge fan of Chris Pratt, but a good thing for Mario and probably a good thing for whatever Nintendo decides to do moving forward. I've read that there was a Zelda movie in the works. Thoughts, guys? Is it a good thing that this movie, which is not the best movie out there, but seems good enough for kids. You know, is it a good or bad thing that's being so successful?
I think it kind of speaks to Nintendo's kind of expertise at stewarding their IP, to sound like a Wall Street Journal article. They're really good at that type of thing. They just opened up the theme park in California. It was a very good movie. It, you know, for kids, for 40-year-old kids, it pretty much hit all the notes for me. There was enough like fan service and a kind of like inside references that unless you really played the games to death, you wouldn't have noticed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was just really well executed. And yeah, I you know, let there be more. I would look forward to a Zelda movie, a Mario 2. I like the Donkey Kong was in there. This is about as good as it was going to be, I think.
It's very basic and sort of like my thing is it's also like very safe, right? I almost feel like Nintendo like was there, like Nintendo executives were there approving every single decision, like whatever happened here. It's like we cannot have another Mario movie failure, right? It has to be perfect. It has to be exactly what the fans want. And I do kind of feel like it's a bit constrained by that because ultimately it is Mario goes to the Mushroom Kingdom with Luigi and, you know, they defeat Bowser. Like, that's it. It's everything we've seen before. You hit some Smash Brothers references. You get some Mario Kart stuff in there. You have Seth Rogen as Donkey Kong. Good casting. I don't think he was actually doing that much. But, you know, Jack Black as Bowser, not going full Meatloaf, but certainly Bowser doing a few, like, rock ballads on the piano. Like, that was fun. Fun enough, I feel like, is a thing. I'm hoping, like, moving forward, like, Nintendo lets them actually stretch a little, maybe creatively. I don't know. Like, maybe I compare everything to the Lego movie, which is a freaking masterpiece, right? And we've had so many good animated movies, mainly because of Christopher Miller and Philip Lord. I mean, they were partially behind Into the Spider-Verse as well. So, really, anything those guys touch is gold. But we're a little spoiled. And I do not understand the abject hate from some of the reviews for this movie because I have a lot of film critic friends, and some people like, want to destroy this movie, even though I'm like, guys, I sat through Space Jam 2, you know, I've sat through far worse movies aimed at kids that activate far fewer brain cells than this thing. So I don't know. I was totally fine with it. Anthony, Doc, like, will you guys ever end up seeing it, you think?
I'll probably have no choice because of my niece, but uh-huh. I'm just glad to hear somebody else say that they're not a fan of Chris Pratt.
I mean, listen, say, yeah, that's a whole online controversy. I think he's perfectly fine. The internet kind of turned on him at one point. I loved him in Parks and Rec. I loved him in the first two Guardians of the Galaxy movies. And then I think it was Jurassic World where everybody was like, oh, no. What if we allowed Chris Pratt to turn into? And I hate Jurassic World so much.
Yes. All right, cool. We're on the same page. Right down the list. You covered it.
That's like the whole thing. I think the thing is there was a lot of controversy around his casting, right? And mainly because people were like, didn't he just voice a cartoon man? Like he was also the lead in the Lego movie, which is a very good movie. His Mario voice is kind of uninspired, and this movie also had a big delay, and I think we don't fully know like what was the cause of that delay, if it was like story work or whatever, but it could have been something as simple as like having to redo the lines. And there were stories that his original Mario voice was a little like Tony Soprano-esque, and maybe Nintendo didn't want that. Understandable, I guess. Yeah.
The next one will be voiced by 11 Labs. So I guess we got to take Pratt while we're
oh my God. I mean, Charles Martinet is in the movie, the voice of Mario as we know him, but not playing. He's playing Mario's dad, another character I'll keep a little secret.
Aww.
It's a fun little surprise. But yeah, he's literally Mario's dad. So anyway, Mario movie is a thing, hugely successful. Take that, Sonic, I guess. I don't know. It's more successful than Sonic, except I think that movie is actually more fun and took more creative risks because it had Jim Carrey in full-on, like, Jim Carrey zany mode. So, man, it's a weird thing to think about. But I guess also Sega had far less to lose, right?
So true.
Kind of in other gaming news, something I want to mention too that broke towards the end of this week. There was a report from Insider Gaming about a new PlayStation handheld, and a very confusing one because according to the report, it has an 8-inch screen. It is all it does is remote play from the PlayStation 5. That's at least according to the report. It is a screen that you hold with a game controller, and apparently has like DualSense. It has like the DualSense motion stuff and the haptic feedback, but it is just a dummy screen for the remote play on the PS5. We don't know if this is actually going to be a thing, but looking at Sony as a company, I am always deeply frustrated with. I'm like, this sounds like a dumb thing Sony would do. Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Thoughts, guys, if this actually ends up being a remote play device only?
I will say that I'm surprised at how popular remote play and kind of local game streaming is. I did not you don't have to go far online to find people talking about how awesome it is. So that was kind of surprising to me. I guess if Sony wants, I mean, they've seen the success of the Switch, the Steam Deck, which to me was the gadget gadget last year. Mm-hmm. And it has really kind of changed the way that I play games pretty substantially, actually. And then there are smaller kind of Chinese companies, Airbnic, Retroid, produce these handheld devices that unlock the ability to play to stream games either from the cloud or from your local network. Mm-hmm. That was not a thing 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago. So I guess I would also agree that I'm a little bit frustrated with what Sony does. It's like, why can't you just make the Vita too?
Why can't you just be good?
Just be normal?
Just be normal. I reviewed, I think 2 or 3 years ago, I reviewed some Nex speakers that Sony made, which were literally like, it was like a cow collar that sits around your neck and they're just speakers that point up. And they didn't support Bluetooth. They were requiring this weird, like, wired dongle. And they were very clunky. And they didn't sound good. And they cost, like, I think over $300. And the entire time I was writing my write-up of that thing, I was like, what are you doing, Sony? Like, you're Sony. You gave us the Walkman. You gave us the PlayStation. Nobody wants neck speakers. What are you doing? Meanwhile, they can still produce some of the like best headphones out there. Their noise canceling stuff are still really good. It's just funny to me. Like I would not be surprised if Sony made a thing like this. The only thing is, if it was $100 or less, I could see that being useful to people if they just want to remote play from their PlayStation 5. Otherwise, just you could probably get any sort of like game streaming, you know, handheld that would cost 200 ish and would also be able to use cloud streaming, which I think to a lot of people would be more useful, right?
Yeah, I think that was one of the bigger criticisms of the Logitech from last year, where it was like really cool device, but it was like it's like $100 too expensive for what it does. So pricing seems to be for the if you're just releasing a screen, basically you have to price that appropriately. If it's not like a full powered console or whatever, and you're just selling a screen with some buttons attached to it, people are aware of what that should cost. And especially Sony, I mean, they just launched the PSVR 2, which doesn't appear to have done super well, at least the early indications.
So
I don't know what they're doing hardware-wise.
So slow sales error, and I reviewed the PSVR 2, and my main complaint there was like, oh my God, this hardware is amazing. Why is it more expensive than the PlayStation 5? So what are you doing? It is strange. I mean, the tech in the PSVR 2 is very good. Like compared to a lot of other VR headsets, I'm sure they're probably already selling that at a loss. But if they want this thing to actually succeed, Sony kind of has to bite the bullet a little more, I'd say. Anthony, have you partaken in any of these little handheld gaming devices? Because I don't know. I don't think you have a PC that would play games, but these things like solve a lot of problems for you and people like you who want to play games. Yeah.
Honestly, like, I think that most of my gaming at this point is, like on my Mac or on my iPad. So I'm not like a super serious gamer. I did own the original PlayStation PSP, and that is actually the one Sony device, I mean, gaming device that I've ever purchased. So, you know, bring back the PSP. Why not? But I think like the Steam Deck obviously is the one that is the most interesting to me. And I felt like, at first, a lot of the reviews were saying, hey, it's not quite there. This is really for, people who really want to be on the bleeding edge. And now it seems like it's starting to get to the point where I am considering it. I'm not especially, very seriously.
Yeah. With the price breaks, I do feel like for you, Anthony, and for like a lot of people who can't justify a gaming PC or even like a game console, something like that is just like, well, you could use it as sort of a console. You could dock it to your TV. But also it would give you access to so many games that you're probably hearing people talk about and you have no easy way to play, you know, and with cloud streaming, you could play games that are even too powerful for that handheld system to handle. So
that'd what be was cool about the PSP when it was out and very popular at the time was during my time in college in Japan. And then so the amount of people forget that, you know, Sony, although it's a globalist company, they're still a Japanese company at heart.
Yes.
So two things that come to mind. Number one, if I hired Anthony and I'm the boss, it's hard for me to fire him because it makes me look like I did something dumb. Mm-hmm. So what they might do is put him on a project in the corner, like, I need you to make neck speakers. And after you make those neck speakers and they're hot trash,
good job, buddy.
Like, that was a dumb idea. Anthony, Gomenesai.
Wow.
So I'm assuming those are like
just sweating nice, imagining this.
Those are seppuku jobs, right? I'm imagining. But to me, that device was so good. And so I traveled from basically nearby Ginza, a place called Edogawabashi, every day to Kanagawa to go to my university. And so that time in the train, everybody was, you know, with their PSPs, or at that time, the DS was very popular.
Yeah.
And everybody.
What year was this? Was this like 05?
06.
06? Okay.
Yeah. 05, 06. Yeah. So everybody's there playing all of the games, and it was fantastic. You would go to these stores, you would meet people outside and, you know, discuss new games and, you know, trade gamer handles and things like that. You know, it was really cool situation. The phone brought a lot of that level stuff, but the controls are junk. So when Steele and these other guys made boxes you can wrap your phone with, that would do it. Or the last update that allows us to just connect a DualShock controller or an Xbox Elite controller to your phone and go to town, that kind of like covered it. But there was something so dope about a device that was just for gaming. So because Switch is doing so good, I would love for Sony to get out of their own way and come back. And even Microsoft, because I'm actually a little bit more Xbox these days. I would appreciate them coming up with the Switch level device. And the hardest part of that right now, I believe, is the only people that make a processor dope enough to do all of that ain't giving them the processor. And that's my team. So they got to come up with a processor that's, you know, MX oriented that will allow them to bring all of that firepower to such a small device.
I mean, one of the reasons the Steam Deck has done so well is because of, you know, better Radeon like mobile graphics. That's kind of it. Like, and the GPU's getting better for handheld. So I could see Microsoft dipping their toes in this. There have been rumors about that too. But at the same time, like, man, I sometimes just pick up my Vita and look at that thing and was like, this is a beautiful object. This is a beautiful piece of consumer electronics. And I really wish Sony had given it more of a chance. You know,
whoever gets in bed with Nvidia and locks them down will bring it to the table, because Nvidia is the closest right now. And Nvidia just has some amazing stuff. So whoever can, like, without them trying to do their own thing, because they're not good at doing that, right? They need to work with a legacy partner. And I feel if Sony and or Microsoft would jump in with Nvidia and be like, let's lock this down and not lose it, they could take on and just bury the Switch.
It could be. I mean, that could be something. I do feel like everyone's looking at AMD now, because the PlayStation 5, the Xbox, all the Xboxes are powered by AMD, and AMD is much better at integrated hardware rather than Nvidia. So,
true story.
Yeah. We'll see. I would love to see that. I would just love to see Sony succeed again, because I wrote a piece a couple of years ago, I think, on Sony's, like, one of Sony's major anniversaries, and they would not talk to me for that piece. And the piece ended up being, will Sony ever be like a consumer electronics king or titan again? Because it doesn't seem like it. Like, they're a company held up entirely by PlayStation and Spider-Man at this point, pretty much.
Losing like the mini disc battle broke my heart. I have a stack right there. I have a massive stack of mini discs, and my player finally gave out. But to me, that was one of the dopest pieces of tech. And somebody's mentioning in the chat how that the PSP ran on mini disc. Yo, I was heavy into my music creation at the time.
I was so in high school. I would look at the mini discs and be like, this is cool. This is the future. Because it would also occasionally pop up in anime, right? And I was like, Japan's just another planet, because the tech that they have is just far beyond whatever I was living with at the time. So, okay.
Great.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what's going to happen with this potential.
In Japan, you can actually rent them, you know, so you want to hear a new album. And it was like a lot of Final Fantasy game soundtracks or whatever. You would just go to Sataya and rent your little mini disc and listen to that on the train on the way to class. You know, it was so cool. And I was really sad to see it go.
That's a shame. That's a shame. You know what? Like, yeah, I'm hoping Sony comes back with something. By the way, this thing's reportedly called the Q Lite. And if that is the name, then it does make sense. It's just like a remote streaming box. So that's kind of the thing. That totally makes sense. And you know what? I also co-host the Engadget podcast, guys. And what I like to do at the end of my show is to like talk to you all about what you're watching, what you're experiencing right now. So is there anything that's making you happy these days? Any pop culture, any media you want to shout out to tell the world about on Twit?
I just started watching Beef on Netflix. And it's hard to watch because there's so much tension and it's like so real in a lot of ways. But not to get super deep or anything, but like, you know, I'm an Asian American guy, like, and I'm in therapy right now. One of the things we talk a lot about is like being an Asian American and anger and repression. And like, this is perfect. Like, literally, I want my next therapy session to just be like, hey, can we just like watch Beef together and talk about it? But even if that's not you, I think it's a great show. I mean, it's just like, the acting is amazing. Like, it's like really weird too. And everything just feels like perfectly observed. I highly, highly recommend Beef.
Just to frame it, Beef is Steven Yeun versus Ali Wong and like an epic beef battle, which starts off with a road rage incident and just like gets more and more crazy and kind of wild. A critic I really enjoy, and one of my friends, Roxana Haddadi, her review at Vulture is Beef feels bad, but she loves it. So it's a positive review, but it's bad vibes because of like how tense the show makes you. So that is a really good one. Thank you, Anthony. You guys have anything else you want to shout?
It's funny. I'm watching Beef. Of course, here's something that you guys might not know. Most of my crowd knows. I was adopted by a Korean family. So I grew up mostly in Asian culture and went to college in Japan. I live in Hawaii, which is, 76% Asian population. So I fully understand what's going on in Beef. And it's kind of hilarious to me because I'm like, if my dad was still alive, he would look at Steven and be like, that's you when you drive, My dad always get mad at me because I'm such a road rager. But my road rage would come from Hawaii people just drive bad. And, growing up in the East Coast, like I was around bad people that actually knew how to drive. In Hawaii, they're bad people that can't drive. So, and my dad used to always give me so much crap because I was always yelling at people. They can't hear you. So if you're going to yell at them, roll down the window so they can hear you. And I'm like, then we're going to have to get into a fight. And so, yeah, Beef is a trip. But for me, I don't know why, because it's so campy and it's so cheesy, but it's the best thing running. It's like water is not special, but when you're super thirsty, an ice cold glass of water is so refreshing. And to me, Ted Lasso is water. Like it keeps getting better, now they're teasing us with this being the end, and yet they might, there's a lot of like side conversation about there might be back with another four. Lasso is just so good, and it just lets you know that TV can be great and doesn't have to be so messed up and controversial, whatever. You can touch on issues without being campy about it. And I think, again, Secret Sauce, I've been far removed from the fruit farm, but I'm rooting for us as a streaming service. So, winning 11 Emmys and having them do so well. And then, when you're done with that, you can watch Shrinkage.
Shrinking to something else.
All right, Dev. So you're the one old guy, he says dumb stuff. But yeah, it's so good. And I hope that they can continue, and I'm ready to see some of the spinoffs because I feel it has positively impacted so, so many people. And that's just rare in TV nowadays. Yeah.
It's a sweet show. It's about people trying to be better people and kinder and nicer to each other, even though there is swearing, there are adult situations and there's like conflict in there too. It's such a rare show. But I also throw another shout out to Shrinking, Doc, because I've been watching that too. That's co-created by Brett Goldstein, who's also on Ted Lasso and also a writer on Ted Lasso. And also Bill Lawrence, who co-created Ted Lasso and also is the creator of Scrubs. So if you like the vibes of Scrubs, if you like that, another feel good show, awesome show, still like holds up today if you rewatch it. Shrinking is a show about a therapist who kind of has like an existential crisis, is dealing with the grief of the death of his wife. And it's about him trying to piece his life back together. And it's very much like Ted Lasso in that it is kind of a sad story about somebody who's kind of hurt, but it's really about everybody coming together to help them and then trying to like find their purpose in life. So Shrinking, also really good. Like, shout out Bill Lawrence. Thank you. Thank you for bringing Bill good Lawrence, TV man. To us. Thanks. Nicholas, anything you want to shout out?
There is a local game store here in Tucson that will be having a Game of Thrones trivia night in a few weeks.
And I am now watching Game of Thrones more or less for the first time. This show,
wow.
People. Yeah, I feel like I saw some of the episodes when it first came out, but not really, basically. And so I'm just about to wrap up season one. It helps to have the subtitles on. Uh-huh. But it is very good. I'm enjoying it so far. So this is hot new show that I'm watching, Game of Thrones season one.
How far are you going to try to get before the trivia night?
I think I got 2 weeks. I feel like I could finish a season. It's been like 2 or 3 days. So I don't know. Probably at least half I'm shooting for. I don't anticipate doing well in trivia, to be honest. But that's what I'm up to.
I mean, you're going to power through the good seasons. I think you'll have a good time with that. Well, all right, folks. Well, thank you so much. Anthony Ha from ENIAC Ventures. How are things going in Harlem and New York, Anthony?
Things are good. You know, I think sometimes you hear things about how cities are crazy now. New York is great. And not everything's perfect. Yeah. I mean, rent is still insane. Don't get me started on that. But
another reason I probably can't live in the city again with a family. But
I don't know. I feel like things just have to get a little bit worse and then maybe rent will get better. We'll see. Fingers crossed.
All right. We've got Doc Rock from YouTube and Hawaii. And now I'm so jealous, Doc Rock, of like your life in Hawaii. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's good for the weather. There are other reasons why I wish I was able to go somewhere closer, because I'm going to NAB in a couple of days. And it's just always a trek. You know, like at when I'm at home in the mainland, like I'm just right there. But here it's like a whole trek. And so, funny, we were talking about conferences. I'm fixing to go to a conference that is not going to be, you know, as fun as E3, but I'm ready to go.
Awesome. And actually, I forgot to ask, but Doc, where can we find you on the internet these days?
I'm Doc Rock on just about anything, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I do a lot of stuff on Ecamm live channel on YouTube and on my own personal channel on YouTube. And I mostly talk about trying to get people who run businesses to understand that creating is probably the best way to really connect with your customers. And so if you miss the social media boat or whatever, don't worry about it. I can teach people how to get their creative juices flowing to connect with their community and stuff like that, because it is just amazing when you guys do your podcast and it's live and we all get to watch. To me, that's the interaction that people are missing. And you can tell by the chat. Look at all these lovely people in the chat hanging out with us today on Easter.
Thank you, chat. Thank you.
You know what I mean? So yeah, big ups to those guys.
And Anthony, where can we find you online, by the way?
I'm at Anthony Ha most places, though not on Gmail, which I'm still bitter about. I guess if you're a founder and interested in talking to me in my ENIAC capacity, we're just ENIAC.VC. And then I have a podcast where we review streaming shows, original content.
Original content. Love it. Nicholas De Leon from Consumer Reports.
Yeah.
How are you doing? You know, and
I'm
where can
great.
We find you online?
Yeah. Yeah. No. Consumer Reports. I have nothing in particular to plug, just consumerreports.org. All the stuff is there. I do have a personal project, the Our Time Show, which is a podcast about like the watch industry. So like Rolex and Seiko and that type of thing, if folks want to check it out. But yeah, just CR.org. And I'm working on a lot of home office stuff recently. Some I can't talk about right now, but nothing in particular to plug. So just search Consumer Reports and that'll do it.
I think we can find you on Twitter too, right, Nicholas?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. It's mostly like sports stuff and video games. So don't come for like CR advice, but please fill the email. I feel like I field questions via email from folks kind of frequently. I'm happy to answer any question that I can that is within kind of my remit or point you in the right direction of the person who does the car stuff or who does like the refrigerator stuff. Just reach out to me. I'm happy to help basically in any capacity that I can.
Great. Thank you so much. I love you. I love this crew.
That's cool.
What's up, Doc?
I say, who knew he was a horrorist? That's cool. I actually like that.
That's super cool. I also, that word always confuses me. It's like, is that a new frame for just people who really like horror movies?
Never mind. I thought you were asking. That is so bad.
That's a whole other thing. You guys can find me. I'm Devendra Hardwar. I'm senior editor at Engadget. I review PCs, all sorts of fun stuff. And I also co-host the Engadget podcast there with Sherlyn Lowe. And we talk about tech and news weekly. I also talk about movies and TV on the Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. So if you liked our little pop culture conversation, you want to hear more of that, that's where you'll go to find it. And Anthony, we have to have you back on at some point. And all you guys, I want to get you on at some point, okay?
I'd love that.
Let's go.
All right. Thanks, folks. Twit records every Sunday at twit.tv/twit. Another twit is in the can. Amazing.